Just like Jim just make that a
The House Senate Transportation Committee will come to order. Folks, today we're going to do things just a little bit differently. You know, just learn a few things every now and again. But after the last meeting, members were, you know, we just didn't have enough time to get to all the questions. We're going to do it a little different today. If you have a question, make sure that Billy here sees your hand waving around. We'll put you down. We're going to go Senate, House, Senate, House, Senate, House. Everybody gets to ask. So that person that gets called on, you get to ask your question and do a follow-up, but we're not going to let anybody else interject. All right? So there's not going to be any of this to that point. If I feel that anybody's getting a little too long-winded, you know, that's what this is for. We're going to use it today. We're going to keep things moving along. There's a lot of information that these folks that are coming they've got a lot of information to give us. We don't need to be making speeches of whatever kind. Folks, I just want you to know that there's the official agenda is the one that's titled Transportation Budget and Policy Division, Wednesday, August 22nd, 2007, 1 p.m. State Office Building. It's not the one that was put out by the Department of Transportation. Those are the folks that they're going to have here that will be able to answer questions. With that, I'm going to ask Mayor R.T. Ryback to come to the table. And for the folks that are going to provide testimony, the mayor and I have spoken. The mayor has agreed to make an opening statement, try to keep it short, answer as many questions as possible. Folks, these people have a lot of work to do. We want to get as much information as possible in the short period of time that the mayor is going to be with us. After the mayor is here, I believe Congressman Obistar is going to come, give us a quick brief about what's happening at the federal level. We'll be able to ask some questions of him, and then we'll work down through the rest of the list. With that, Mr. Mayor, thanks for being here today.
Very good. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. We very much appreciate the opportunity to work with you. On August 1st, there was a bridge that fell in the city of Minneapolis, but it was one of the busiest bridges in the state of Minnesota. And as we've learned, tragically since then, as the stories one by one have come out about who was on that bridge, this bridge involved people from all over the state, and the implications involved people from all over the state. While the actions fall directly on the city of Minneapolis, especially in the municipal consent process, we fully recognize that our role is to be in as deep a partnership as we can possibly be with all of you from all over the state right now. So we want to, first off, thank you for the opportunity to be here and also say that we have been in dialogue with many of you and will continue to do that as time goes on. With me today are Steve Kotke, who is our chief engineer and leads our public works department. He has become almost a common law employee of MnDOT, having worked so closely with them over this period of time, and will continue to do that. Councilmember Sandy Colvin-Roy, who chairs our Transportation Committee, and Councilmember Betsy Hodges, who chairs our Intergovernmental Relations Committee, are part of the team here as well. We have obviously been working quite a bit on this bridge, and much of it has been covered in the public. The process is the following. We've been in discussions with people from MnDOT and the governor as well with our goals for the bridge. We felt it was very important for us to be able to move quickly during this period of time, and also even more important to do it right. So toward that end, what the city did is that we quickly got our council members together, and we passed last Friday a statement of principles, which laid out in specific all of the goals that we have for the bridge. And we passed that, and we'll use that as a guide as we move into the municipal consent process. On Monday, we received the final layout from the state. That triggered the municipal consent process. We then had 15 days to set a hearing on that, but we set it on the very first day we could set it, and the hearing is now set for the 20th of September. We're moving as quickly as we can in that process as we do that. The issues on this are going to be discussed in the Minneapolis municipal consent process, but as I emphasized These are really Minnesota issues, and they break down into three key issues. The first one is whether this bridge is transit ready or not. It is, we believe, probably too early to determine whether this is, for instance, the right alignment for the Central Corridor, but we do believe it is far too early to decide that there should never be transit in the corridor, and that's why we held the position that we thought the bridge should be transit ready. We deeply appreciate the fact that the governor and MnDOT have heard that. Many of you have heard that as well. The governor has signaled that he is open to that, and in fact, the layout that we received did show the bridge will be transit ready. We think that's very important, not only for planning in the next few years, but we obviously intend this to be a 100-year bridge, and we want to make sure it has a long-term vision. The other issues really break down to congestion on either side of the bridge. The original layout, we had some concerns that there would be a bottleneck as you went over the river, moving away from the city toward the northern suburbs. We believe there has been some great progress on that. We'll continue to work on that. There are also a collection of issues on the south end involving congestion coming over the bridge into downtown. That area was already identified as a bottleneck, especially as you reach Washington Avenue. We think there are some solutions that may not be that expensive. We continue to work with MnDOT on that. And so those issues about transit on the bridge and congestion on either side of the bridge really represent the key part of that. There will be a number of small issues that emerge from this that are very large issues to those who live around the bridge. Whether traffic can continue to go under the bridge so neighbors can be served, how this relates to 10th Avenue on the other side, how this relates to traffic in the interim, how this relates to the congestion on the freeways. All of those issues are being worked with day by day. We have a meeting each morning. We address these issues, and they're changing quite a bit. It's clear that while many of these costs will be covered as part of the emergency response, some of those issues that I just mentioned will not be. It'll be about $100,000 here to add a stoplight signal, another $100,000 there, another couple hundred thousand to do to make the 10th Avenue Bridge accessible to pedestrians, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it is a concern to us that those issues are mounting up. And that's one of the many reasons why we feel so strongly about the need for a special session that addresses both the transportation funding and also local government aid issues. But with that, I want to conclude my very short opening and offer you the opportunity to ask any questions and see if I can help with that.
Mr. Mayor, in regards to, I think we all agree that the transit-ready bridge is probably a better option, even if the transit is probably 20 years down the road. In regards to the congestion on the north end and then somewhat on the south end, do you feel that MnDOT is addressing the needs of the city?
We've been in very close partnership, and I do want to make sure that we're saying these are issues. The people who will be in that congestion are primarily people from outside of the city, so we really see these as statewide issues. We do think MnDOT has been working with us very closely. Among the issues that we worked on is that we identified the potential of having the bridge, for instance, reach land earlier at a lower point, meaning that it would provide a longer ramp, if you will, as you hit the non-downtown side, the north side, and that could begin to address the congestion. Issues like that are being being dealt with. There are still some challenges, I would say, that probably looking out long-term, the first two bridges on the north side of the river are where a bottleneck is created, and if that is addressed long-term, that would create tremendous capacity on that freeway for many years to come. So that's one of the issues. On the south side, before this occurred, we identified that the interchange was probably at the wrong place. Washington Avenue is currently at a critical congestion level. Before this happened, our long-term transportation plan worked on with the state identified that there should be another way to get on and off the freeway, possibly in addition to this. Doing something, an improvement like that is expensive. It's most expensive to shut the freeway. So while it's shut, should something be done? We're now working with our engineers and MnDOT's engineers on several less expensive ways to do that, possibly by adding an additional entrance roughly around the Metrodome area. to take some of that congestion out of that. I'm obviously mindful as I come in on 35W in the morning to the log jam that's created on as people cross over to that to get onto 94, and that clogs up the freeway. We certainly don't want that to happen. NDOT is aware of that. We're working with them on that, and that's an issue that affects obviously anyone coming through there. The short answer is yes, they're working with us.
Great, thank you. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, Mayor, you referenced the partnership, and I think we're all interested in seeing everything work out smoothly. But if you could comment from your perspective what the local review or local approval actually means, what the city's role is, let's say if there were in the end some disagreement where you wanted to go one direction and others wanted to go a different direction. What exactly does that local approval mean?
Right. And Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, the municipal consent process, of course, is a state process mandated by the state and given to cities. As I said at the outset, I think it's important to repeat, this is a process that's given to the city, but because of the regional and statewide significance of this bridge, we really see our role as representing all of the states. So, for instance, when the public hearing occurs, we would appreciate all of you communicating to all of your constituents that that's a point where it's very appropriate from anyone from the state to testify. We think that's what the process should be. We recognize that that's often a very lengthy process, and we also recognize that in this period of time, we should be doing everything possible to compress that time. We have to do the job, and we have to do it right. We also believe that we can get that done in record time. So, for instance, one of the things we did in this process that's different than others is by passing our statement of principles early, we basically said to all of our elected officials, let's identify up front what those issues are. Let's also vet those with MnDOT before this process even begins. And many of those issues have already been addressed. And in fact, the governor's letter to us yesterday really referenced the fact that they believe they can meet the statement of principles that we have. That really helps us compress the time frame. The hearing on the 20th is an important time because that's the one point at which the public can officially come forward and raise their issues. I think one of the questions we have is whether an RFP and a final contract are left before that point and whether that gives the public the appropriate sense that they have the right to weigh in or not. That's really more, frankly, Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson, that's really more an issue for the state. This is a process that you mandate and direct to the cities, and we're following the letter of the law, but doing it as quickly as possible.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman, and one of the things, I got to bring this up because 16 years I've been involved in transportation issues, and we've talked about the Northwest Corridor, the Cedar Corridor, the Central Corridor, the Red Rock Corridor, the Southwest Corridor, and the Rush Line Corridor. In the 16 years, I never heard of anybody running a light rail across where people are now talking about light rail.
Well, Senator Day, that started almost 30 years ago that they've talked about that.
What corridor would that be called? I'll put it on my list here.
Mr. Mayor?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I believe that was called the Northwest Diagonal, and as I recall, the primary challenge with that very promising route, which would go through Roseville and toward White Bear Lake, the primary challenge was the difficulty in getting into the core of the city. This would obviously open up that as being something that would be now a potential. So it would be a very significant breakthrough for that line. That being said, of course, I'm not the state's transportation planner, and there are greater minds than mine that will be part of this, but now for the first time ever, there's the opportunity to do that. You could potentially also have this be the nexus between, if Central Corridor did happen to come through that route, those two lines could now intersect. That could also intersect whether either of those also were a bus rapid transit line. So the potential is great, but I think what has happened in these discussions, and I'm very pleased that the governor has been cooperative on this point, is that we may not know today, but it certainly would be unwise for us to make a decision today that limited all those options into the future. The current design keeps those options open. I think it's wise.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think it's wise. It's $35 million. I guess I would agree with Congressman Overstar. If we needed to, we'd build our own road across there, some there's bridge across there at some time down the line, but as you well know, I haven't been totally supportive of the light rail we already have, because we got $700 or $800 million into that, and I dubbed that the train to nowhere. This would be the train to nowhere too. But I can tell you that we're, for the amount of riders and what we're doing in our whole light rail discussion, I mean, if anybody ever thought about, you know, 160 to 200,000 people going across the bridge, and we have like 20,000 people a day riding the light rail of the entertainment train, and think of the cost. You know, one cost $700 to $900 million, and this bridge cost $300 million. It'd be a great, great thing. But I just, to me, all of a sudden, a bridge goes down, and we now have another transit corridor, and we can't even get done all the transit corridors we already want to get done. So, but that being said, I know that people are saying we're gonna do more light rail. We're gonna do more light rail. I mean, Congressman Oberstar, he's light rail guy, and everybody is. About 4% of our people are light rail. It's sucking up about 25-30% of our costs, and the other 95% are out here on highways and roads and bridges, and we don't have enough funding, and yet we keep spinning this whole thing, doing this light rail thing. So I had to weigh in on it, and I'll shut up and listen, and I'm sure we'll have a little segment of nothing for 40 years.
Thank you, Senator Day. Any other questions, Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have quite the same reaction to Senator Day, but thinking through this, why would we put light rail, I presume it's in the center of an interstate? That's the part that puzzles me, because you're kind of locked into the center, and think of how you get people to it. You have to come through some crossways, you know, the bridges cross, which are usually busy arterials, and get down to it. But it seems to me if we were trying to lure people into transit, we want to make it convenient for them. And the middle of an interstate is not convenient. If you put it on the side, then how do you get the traffic over it to enter? Engineering-wise, that seems very difficult. It would seem to me that the flexibility of the buses on an interstate in terms of transit is much easier than to lock into that. And I just wondered why that is such a key thing.
Mr. Mayor.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, I think you raised a really good point about having flexibility of transit options. For instance, you represent people who now have the benefit of looking at the beginnings of what will be congestion pricing experiments on 394. The width and the capacity of that freeway allows for those options at that time. That's essentially, Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, what we're looking at in this case. As these discussions have taken place quickly, what we've really come with is something that provides us the flexibility to do what greater minds in the future determine is happening. We are in a period of time where transit and transportation is evolving rapidly. We're blessed that during the period when this horrible tragedy took place, we received an extraordinarily significant grant from the federal government that we had lobbied quite hard on, called the Urban Partnership Agreement. What that's really about is 35W having the capacity all the way from Lakeville into the core of the city to look at bus rapid transit, congestion pricing, and other models there. That flexibility will now be possible with this bridge, whatever the tool may be it light rail, be it bus rapid transit being in the center or the side of the freeway. Had we not made the decision that we have made, and I think the governor supports, we would be limiting all those options. I don't know what the end result is. I know this bridge gives us the flexibility to do that in the future.
Senator Olson, I think we need to take our committee down to Chicago and take a look at what they do along the Dan Ryan Expressway, because all the transit is right down through the middle of all that. And it works, because there's a lot of people riding those trains. So, Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I think what we may not be aware of is that this decision about whether to make bridges transit ready or rail ready is not a new issue. That the Bloomington Ferry Bridge a long time ago made a determination that it should prepare for the future and be constructed in such a way that would be an option. On the other hand, for whatever reason, Dakota County decided on Cedar Avenue Bridge intentionally not to, and I think it has to do with some of the anti-rail feeling at the time down there. My guess is, in the not-too-distant future, there might be some in that county who wish they had made very different decisions, and there might be a small investment now that saves us a huge investment in the future, and maybe even doesn't allow us to move us to the future. So this is not something new. This is not a new planning idea that when we build bridges, we do this.
Well, folks, is there any more questions for Mayor Ryback? Thanks for coming again, Mr. Mayor, and any time that you need to talk to any of us, just give us a jingle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to thank you and all the members and your constituents who've been remarkable in helping us as we've wrestled with these issues, and we want to say that this is something that involves the whole state, and we also obviously want to be in the position as the largest city in the state of responding when you have needs, for instance, as you and I discussed in your district this morning. So this has been a great exercise in partnership, and we want to continue to be that partner.
Well, thank you, Mr. Mayor, and on behalf of everyone around the table here, we just want to applaud the response that the first responders from the city of Minneapolis and all around the area and all the citizens made in regards to the I-35 bridge. They did a wonderful job, and I think that you and your staff need to be commended, as well as I just want to, on a personal note, say thank you to the city for sending so many relief supplies down to our neck of the woods, too. So thank you. Mary Litt, I'm sorry, Representative Holberg, you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, and I agree with the comments of Senator Murphy. Your city did a great job, and heard from people in Dakota County that have been up there, and were impressed with the reaction. But I'm curious about the economic impact to your city. Are you taking any steps to identify those costs or quantify them for the period of time that this bridge is down, what it means as far as people coming to eat or all those kinds of things?
Mr. Chair, Representative Holberg, there are direct out-of-pocket costs that the city has, and then I think you're also identifying the intangible costs. The out-of-pocket costs are roughly in the $10 to $15 million range right now. That's really what it costs us to emergency responders. That was $2.5 million. Traffic control agents by the end of this will be $3.5 million. Those sorts of costs. But the other ones are very difficult to quantify. And I think really when you look at those are the regional costs that we have. This is one of the, if not the busiest bridge in the state. And as we've heard all these stories of people who were on or near that bridge, they're primarily people who were going through the city. So we can look at those costs, and we're trying to get some handle on it. I know MnDOT used a number of 400,000 to a million, the commissioner could do a better job of that. I don't know the methodology on that, but this has a huge dislocation. I should say, however, that we met a day after this with a very large group of business leaders in the city, and have had a really, really terrific partnership with them. So we have a large number of companies, Best Buy, Target, Super Value, I'm unfortunate I can remember all of them, who've agreed, for instance, to reroute trucks through the area. Our downtown transportation network is now continuing to work with businesses to increase the use of metro passes, to subsidize those. Our goal is to drive transit ridership significantly up, to relocate traffic so that we'll have as little of that as possible. But the bottom line is it's a lot harder to get around. And one of the things we've really done, and we really encourage everyone to make a call to your constituents, is that one of the best things you can do in a recovery, we're now not in the period where we need people to deliver water and sandwiches to the recovery site. We need them to buy a metro pass, we need them to carpool, and we need them to even stagger work hours. And those sorts of issues, I think, are not things people come to mind when they think, gee, what is the thing I can do to help in this situation? But that's where literally the rubber is meeting the road right now. So that's, I think, a long way of saying I don't have that number, but it's big.
If I might, is the your statement of principles available on your website,
yes.
The city's website?
Yes, the statement of principles is available on the website. I have a copy of it. That is not it. But we do have the statement of principles. It's out there in public. We very much welcome your comments.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. We're going to move now to Congressman Obestar. And folks, once again, the congressman is going to give us 5 or 10 minutes rendition of where we're at the federal level, and then we're going to ask some questions. But, you know, we don't need to editorialize so much. But we need to get this information. And Senator Day, I think you're going to be very surprised when Mr. Lamb comes up and talks about some of the transit activities that have been going on. Congressman.
Thank you, Senator, Mr. Chairman, Chairman Leader. Thanks to each of the members of the Joint Transportation Committee for once again gathering. I appreciated the opportunity in March to come before the group and discuss the outlook for transportation. Little did we know then what awaited Minnesota in the face of the I-35W bridge. You on both committees have been diligent and thorough in carrying out your responsibilities, and you're continuing this oversight role. I think it's very reassuring to the people of the state of Minnesota. The collapse of that bridge, while a terrible tragedy for the 13 persons who lost their lives, for their families, for all who knew them, for those who escaped but were injured, and for their families as well. This is a tragedy beyond expression. Your sympathies and mine are with all of them. As we all, and some of you have mentioned this earlier, the first responders who, thanks to preparation and training, doing an emergency response drill weeks in advance of this tragedy, unknowing again that it would happen, made Minnesota, Minneapolis, St. Paul, our state government, look like the very picture of appropriate response, in stark contrast to what happened in Katrina. It would be a compounded tragedy if we did not pick up the pieces and do something grander and greater than just rebuild this bridge. We need, on a national level, an urgent response to the backlog among all the states of deficient bridges. It calls for an immediate and urgent response. It's unfortunate that in our democracy, time and again, tragedies focus the public's attention and focus the attention of governments. Shouldn't work that way. We should be anticipatory. But regrettably, on our structured system, we don't work anticipatorily sufficient. Now, this particular bridge collapse, as it could have happened in any other state where 700 other bridges of a similar structure exist, bridges that were built in the same period of time. This happened. But this one, without the redundancies that we know to be designed into bridges of more current status, are scattered all around the country. They're all built in that period of 64, 67. They're all 40 plus years old. They all need to be immediately reinspected. But because it happened here, Minnesota is a poster child for bridge failure. And that calamity has really galvanized public opinion around doing something. The what is less clear, but I've laid out a pathway for what we need to do. But in the immediate situation, I happened be on the House floor managing the conference reports on the Water Resources Development Act. They used to be every year authorization for the Corps of Engineers to do its dredging and levee improvements and locks construction and reconstruction. They haven't done it in 6.5 years, and finally in this Congress, in 6 weeks, we moved that bill through committee, through the House. It took a little longer for the Senate, but in less than seven months, we did the work of 7 years. And I was on the floor managing a conference report, my BlackBerry went off, and I looked in astonishment at the news about a bridge collapsing in Minneapolis, right? Some other state, but not Minnesota. Not here. Not where we have a reputation of building very good bridges. And I announced that on the floor. That night, after our bill passed, the conference report concluded, I gathered my committee staff, drafted legislative language, worked it through the House parliamentarian, made sure we had it all in order, to put in effect an emergency relief legislation. The Senate was not in session. That is, they were, the Senate had technically recessed. They had two caretakers on hand to manage unanimous consent requests. So we had to pre-clear everything we did in the House with the Senate, mostly talking to the Senate staff. By midnight, we had that accomplished. The next morning, I had a markup scheduled in the full committee on transportation infrastructure, introduced the bill as soon as the House convened at 9 a.m., and brought the bill before the committee. We moved it through committee, and then clearance with the House leadership to bring it on the floor. But then we had to get a special rule to take the bill up under suspension of the rules, because the Republican leadership was, at that point of the session, not allowing unanimous consent. So we went to the Rules Committee. We got a rule to bring up the bill and tagged a couple of other bills along with it. By Friday evening, we had the bill passed. We took another little adjustment with the Senate, and we sent it on to the President about midnight, Saturday night. 48 hours, we had $255 million for Minnesota, $250 million for rebuilding the bridge, and $5 million for the transit account for shifting of passengers from vehicular traffic to bus or light rail. We had to, in this legislation, waive the limit in the Federal Highway Act of $100 million in emergency relief and $100 million limit per state, which we did in this legislation, waived both requirements to get Minnesota up to $250 million. And third, made this 100% federal funding, not 90-10, which would have been a normal case since it's on the bridges on the interstate system, which is funded 90% federal. We had remarkable bipartisan support. I want it noted that Congressman Ellison, who of course represents Minneapolis, Congressman Betty McCullum, Jim Ramsey came over moments after I made the statement and said, whatever we need to do, let's do it together. John Klein, Michelle Bachman, Colin Peterson, all joined forces to make this a true Minnesota unified front. And I also talked to Senator Coleman and Senator Klobuchar, who worked with the Senate leadership to pave the way. Now that the funds are approved and we still have to get the appropriations that will come later in this session, in the transportation appropriations process, MnDOT has to follow the procedures. They will award a bid. The contractor will start work on construction of the replacement bridge, bill the state The state, under federal law, will pay the contractor and then submit vouchers to the Federal Highway Administration for approval. Now, the state has to trust that money, as it does in all of the federal aid highway program. Now, I understand that the state is facing a crunch in its highway funding, and I would not want to see funds diverted from other projects in order to meet the state's obligation to upfront these construction costs. That's something I would urge you to take a careful look at. The national picture of deficient bridges is one that is of great concern, deep concern to me. 20 years ago, December 1, 1987, chair of the Investigations Oversight Subcommittee, I held hearings on bridge safety over a two-day period. The Center for Auto Safety testified, "Our national bridge program is in serious trouble. The safety of millions of Americans has been jeopardized by inept federal stewardship over our bridge inspection and rebuilding. States have misspent millions of scarce federal aid bridge dollars through dereliction of their responsibility to the traveling public. One of the most fundamental defects of our bridge program is the persistent failure of states to perform reliable, cost-effective maintenance of the nation's bridges in compliance with federal statutory responsibilities. Bridge maintenance is in the Stone Age." We made recommendations to then Reagan administration for improvements in the national and state bridge programs, for safety oversight, for new standards, for training and preparation of bridge inspectors and supervisors. Nothing happened. Well, no longer. We're going to, the legislation I've crafted will deal with that problem. Look, we have 597,340 bridges in the United States, federal and state systems. 154,000 of those bridges are deficient. 73,000 are structurally deficient. On the national highway system, a system of federal aid program, 116,000 bridges carry 70% of all the bridge traffic of the country. Half of those bridges are structurally deficient. 6,100 are critically deficient. Now, that 12% of all bridges carry 70% of all bridge traffic. We have to deal with that issue. So I have drafted legislation that I will introduce on September 4, the day that the House reconvenes, and on September 5 I will hold hearings on that legislation. So we'll do four things. Establish new standards for determination of deficiency, structural, functional deficiency of bridges. We need to have a uniform national standard, and it has to be updated. It hasn't been addressed in 20 years. Federal Highway Administration, working with the states, will immediately update bridge inspection standards, set new standards for determination of bridge deficiency, new standards for training of inspection personnel, supervisory personnel, and data collection. We don't have adequate information about the condition of bridges. In that first title of the bill, all states will be required to inspect, along with Federal Highway Administration, structurally deficient bridges and report their findings to the National Bridge Inventory. Recalculate the load rating on bridges. Ensure that maximum weight limits are being posted on those deficient bridges, either structural deficient or operationally deficient. And establish a computerized management system to track all of the bridges in the federal system throughout the United States. The second is, with that information in hand, the Federal Highway Administration
will then state by state, using state's own findings and recommendations, establish a rating system on the national grid inventory and by each state, with a formula that will evaluate risk to public safety, importance of the bridge to mobility, regional and national mobility, the relative cost to rehabilitate that bridge, whether it's reconstruction, replacement, or simple fundamental maintenance, and evaluate the state's commitment to its financial responsibility to that reconstruction effort. Then I third establish a national bridge rehabilitation and reconstruction trust fund, separate from the Federal Highway Trust Fund, just for bridges. With all that information in hand, then the Federal Highway Administration, together with the state, will establish priority lists, establish cost estimates for response to these critical bridges, and then we'll fund it. And I recommend, this of course will be the role of the Ways and Means Committee, but I recommend a 5-cent increase in the gas tax, highway users fee, be deposited in this bridge reconstruction trust fund, sunset it after 3 years, because this will be a targeted, highly focused program just for this critical section of bridges, and to be earmark proof. No tampering with that priority list once it's established by the executive at the national level and the state level, or by the U.S. House, the U.S. Senate. The trigger mechanism is that if there is any attempt to single out a project from that list, take it in other than its priority listing, Secretary of Treasury is directed to shut down all advances out of that bridge trust fund. I think that will be a powerful incentive. We need something this targeted, focused, urgent response to the national bridge crisis. I will not sit back and allow 20 years ago to repeat itself into the future. I'd be happy to respond to your questions.
Thank you, Congressman. First, I've just got a question, and I didn't hear it. I heard how many bridges were deficient nationally. What's that going to cost?
For a response to the 73,000 structurally deficient bridges, Federal Highway Administration estimates some $65+ billion to respond to those bridges. That's with existing standards. And we need a new standard, and that is why I proposed this upgraded standard. What we would target, though, is those of the most critical nature, those that have the greatest impact on mobility, on transportation, on safety.
Thank you. Senator Olson, I believe you're next.
Microphone, please.
Congress doesn't always appropriate what they authorize, and what is my confidence that this will be done? In fact, in the surface transportation and in aviation, the Congress has always appropriated to the level of the authorization, because that's money out of the Highway Trust Fund. That's contract authority. The executive branch, however, the Office of Management and Budget, has imposed obligation limitations, ceilings, notwithstanding the appropriation level, on how much states can actually obligate. And at the beginning of the current law, State T. Lew, this administration imposed a 15% obligation limitation, cutting back on funding for all states, which meant states then had to go back and rescind contract authority. No, we can't. We cannot prevent the Office of Management and Budget from imposing an obligation limitation once the funds are in the trust fund.
Representative Magnus,
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Congressman Oberstar, thanks for coming in today and testifying. And I also want to thank you for a couple of things. The letter you sent for our hearing last week, I thought was very good. And you talked about it again today, about some of the bridge situation nationwide and the problems we're facing there. And I really appreciate that information. That's been good information to me to pass on to some of my constituents and others, just what's going on there. And secondly, I want to thank you and the rest of the congressional staff and the Bush administration for stepping up quickly to give us the opportunity to handle this tremendous tragedy we've had, and the encouragement that you've given with the money you've looked at.
Let me interrupt for just a moment to express my great appreciation for Secretary Peters. I was on the phone with her that evening after the bridge collapsed, told her what I planned to do. She gave it total support, and her support with went a long way with the both bodies in the Congress.
Thank you. Congressman Oberstar, I understand your proposal here is a 5-cent increase in the federal gas tax for 3 years for bridge improvements and the bridge work you outlined here, and I think that's a good program. Would you suggest that Minnesota does that also, knowing that some of the funding mechanisms we're talking about is increasing the bonding levels, for example, for some of our roads and bridges and others? Is this 5 cent dedicated to bridges something you would recommend Minnesota do also?
Well, I think Minnesota has a broader problem. I think Minnesota has a 20-year lag in funding its surface transportation program. The last time we had a used it, the increases under Governor Rudy Perpich. The value of the highway construction dollar has eroded more than 47% since that time. In 1988-89, Minnesota's gross domestic product was $89 billion. Today, last year, it was $256 billion. In 1989, Minnesotans traveled 36 billion miles on our state highways. Last year, they traveled over 56 billion miles. Traveling more, truck weights have increased, pressure on the roadway has increased, number of trucks rolling, and automotive vehicles have greatly increased. Minnesota is in a much stronger position financially and in a much greater need situation to invest more than just a temporary increase in the user fee in its surface transportation. What I have proposed for the bridge situation is to target those most critically structurally deficient bridges in a very narrowly focused way, sunsetted 3-year sunsetted project to address this critically important sector.
Well, Mr. Chair and Congressman Oberstar, I appreciate those thoughts. Do you anticipate an increase in the federal gas tax, too? If we're looking at all this funding mechanism, I think the federals haven't increased there since 1990, I believe.
93.
So do you anticipate an increase in that coming up, or can you give us a little insight on what your thinking is on that, Congress?
We have been holding hearings in the Surface Transportation Subcommittee of my Transportation Committee on funding mechanisms and needs for investment in our highway and transit accounts of the Federal Highway Trust Fund since the beginning of this session. We'll continue those hearings next year. We're also awaiting the report of the National Commission on Surface Transportation, which was created in the current Safety Lou legislation. They will report by, I think, July of next year. And then in 2009, the current law expires, that is, in August of 2009. We will begin the reauthorization process. We are reviewing all options, public-private partnerships, bonding proposals. Tolls will be on the table, but not long. I'm not a toll fan. I think it's leave it there. We'll evaluate all, but fundamentally, Dwight Eisenhower was right. And he signed the Highway Trust Fund legislation as part of establishing the national system of interstate and defense highways. But a little bit of history is instructive. George Humphreys was Eisenhower's Secretary of Treasury. He proposed a bonding facility to support construction of the 42,500-mile system, which was then estimated to cost $22 billion. And the Congress said, no, we're not going to have the driving public pay Wall Street brokerage firms a fee to manage the public's money. The most efficient way to do this is to have the traveling public pay as they use it, pay-as-you-go system. My predecessor, John Blotnick, was one of the five authors of the Interstate Highway Program and the Highway Trust Fund. And they started out with 3 cents in 1956, deposited into this trust fund. And by the middle of 1957, it was clear they needed additional revenue. An additional cent was proposed. That 1 cent increase in the highway user fee passed the House on a voice vote. Can't even pass the prayer on a voice vote today. But that's the kind of commitment we had as a nation to deal with congestion, loss of life on the highways, need for mobility. And look what it's brought us. Look what the Highway Trust Fund has brought. The greatest mobility of any country in the world. The interstate highway system represents 1% of the nation's mileage and moves 26% of all of the traffic of the nation. That's an impressive accomplishment. And yes, we're going to have to increase the funding because we're seeing decline in vehicle miles traveled, flattening out of revenue into the Highway Trust Fund, and we're reevaluating all of those things. And increase in the user fee off into the future for the Highway Trust Fund will necessarily be on the table.
And Congressman, how much do you think that would be?
As in the bridge proposal, will be dependent upon cost estimates, yes, for the future, and the various revenue sources.
Congressman, quickly. You talked earlier about the money that had to be rescinded back to the federal government. Can you tell us what those have been from our state recently, especially if you have any information on money that was rescinded from the bridge program?
Well, it partially connects with Senator Olson, who asked the question about whether Congress appropriates the funds. Every year, the Office of Management and Budget issues directives to the states in the form of contract authority obligation limitations. That means after you've gotten your allocation, the national program is then, by some magical formula that the gnomes over at OMB cook up. Excuse my disregard for them, but it doesn't make any difference whether Democrats or Republicans over there. Castro came in, they'd all wear a beard. You know, they're all the same. So they say, oh no, you can't spend all the money that's available in the Highway Trust Fund, God forbid. You can only spend this much. So then each state is given a rescission. State of Minnesota, and then it's up to the state to decide where they're going to cut those funds. Which program? Of all the many programs in the federal aid system. In 2003, Minnesota was required to cut $3.78 million under the rescission required by OMB. They took a million, 26%, out of the bridge program. In 2004, they took nothing out of the bridge program. In 2005, required to cut $17.26 million, they cut $332,235 out of the bridge program. In 2006, Minnesota's rescission was $62.58 million,
They took 45.3 million, 72% out of the state's bridge program to meet their obligations. In the current year, 55.46 million was the rescission required of Minnesota. They took 12.3 million, 22% out of the bridge program. For 5 years cumulative, of 58.9 million, 41% of their rescissions were taken out of the bridge program. And that squares with the national figure, although it's higher. States have nationwide taken 29 to 35% of their rescissions out of their bridge program. Now, if you have an urgent need to deal with your bridges, then I don't think you ought to be cutting funds out of them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Congressman. Senator Olstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Congressman, it's a pleasure to have you here today. I've heard you speak before, you know, as we have this opportunity to really maybe get a jump start on our transportation infrastructure in Minnesota, about kind of the pathway that New Jersey had gone down, and that we don't want to go anywhere near that way, although it looked like Minnesota was maybe heading that way a few years ago. Can you kind of address the pitfalls that they have gotten into with using all of their federal dollars and borrowing against them? And then what would be the best way for Minnesota to maximize the federal dollars that we're in a position to receive?
Well, I'm not sure about your reference to New Jersey. New Jersey has actually achieved what other states should achieve, and that is a 10% mode shift to transit. New Jersey has, and if the rest of the nation were to achieve a mode shift of 10% of all trips by transit, we would save the equivalent of all the oil we import from Saudi Arabia. That's 550 million barrels of oil a year. And it's achievable. Nearly every country in the European community has achieved a 10% mode shift to transit. New Jersey can. But in Minnesota, look, in the current law, I orchestrated a $4.3 billion commitment to the state of Minnesota and the safety loop for our highway and transit accounts. That's a 46% increase in funding over the T21 legislation. It includes $626 million in the equity bonus account, which is a flexible amount of money that we decide at the national level to go to each state to help them assure that each state will achieve the 92.5% return on their contributions into the Highway Trust Fund. Now, that $626 million over the 5 years is flexible money. The state can assign to any one of the categories of funding, and it's more than Minnesota would have been entitled to under any formulaic distribution, but I was a senior member at the committee of the conference, and it was my call, and I made it happen. We weren't getting credit in the Highway Trust Fund for the years of ethanol use when it was tax-exempt. And now it's time for a little payback, and I made sure that happened. But Minnesota's got to be able to match those dollars. Remember, under Jesse Ventura, this state sent $175 million back to the Highway Trust Fund because they couldn't match the available dollars. I don't want to see that happen again. It's 80-20. It's 20 cents on a dollar.
Well, my understanding was that New Jersey had borrowed so much money that they were using all of their state gas tax to pay debt service on their bonding.
I'm sorry. I'm not familiar with that. I wasn't aware of that. But I know in the case of state of Indiana, which leased its toll road, it's a designated interstate, but it was not built with interstate highway funds. Not built with federal highway funds. It was built with state funds. And sometime in the 70s, Indiana was able to get it designated Interstate 80. It's not a
It was not built with highway trust fund dollars, so it's up to the state to make its decision to lease it out. They got $3.4 billion from the Spanish management company and took that money and eliminated the state's debt and reserved a small amount of that money for some other transportation needs of the state, but most of it went for debt reduction. Well, I don't think that's a very good, wise use of dollars, but it was their decision. The governor made it.
Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Congressman, I just want to make sure I'm clear on the Federal Highway Trust Fund. Is there a looming deficit in the Federal Highway Trust Fund? And if there is one that remains unaddressed, what might be the effect upon Minnesota if it's not fulfilled?
I assure you we will address it in 2009. There is no consequence in this fiscal year or next fiscal year from the projected shortfall because of a slight decline for the first time in 50 years, decline in vehicle miles traveled as registered by the Federal Highway Administration. That's reporting based on the end of fiscal 06 and the first quarter of this fiscal year. And consequently, there is a slight reduction in revenue into the Highway Trust Fund. That reduction is also attributable to alternative fuel vehicles in relatively small, about 2%. All these projections show there is no urgency or no crisis, but we do have to face it in 2009, and that is why we've been holding hearings, gathering data, evaluating options for the future, and we will address those in the authorizing legislation in 2009. The consequence for Minnesota would be, and for all states, the worst case scenario would be there'd have to be a reduction in the total dollars out of the Highway Trust Fund. But I don't expect that to happen. Truthfully, do not expect that to happen. Not while I'm chairman.
Senator John Bowen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Congressman, thank you for the rapid response in helping us in this tragic time. While you're here, I guess what I'm most curious about, are there any things as we move to make sure the bridge is right, as we kind of take a hopefully a short time out and get it right, are there any things that we need to totally avoid doing or putting into the mix, or what kind of things do we need to be thinking about so we can keep the project on track, get moving forward, or are there any specifics that we need to avoid that would hold the project up on a federal level and federal funding?
I don't know things that would be obstacles. I think you have all the permitting in place. I think the bridge design has been set. I would feel, if I were in your shoes, I would feel more comfortable if an independent analysis were made by an engineering source outside of MnDOT.
Are there further questions for the Congressman? None? Thank you again, Congressman, for coming and bringing your bevy of wisdom to us. Well, thank you again.
Well, thank you for the privilege of being with you.
Yep. With that, we'll ask Mr. Bell and Mr. Lamb and your crew to come down here and can you go ask him what he's got to get out of here?
Thank you very much, Chair Murphy. There's just a few brief introductory remarks that I would like to make along with my colleague, Mr. Lamb, and then I'd like to reserve whatever time we may have to respond to any questions or concerns that the committee may have. there are three areas, very briefly, that we would like to touch on with the committee today. The first and perhaps most important is the response of Metro Transit to the I-35 bridge collapse and the attendant costs associated with that response. The second issue I want to touch on very quickly and very briefly has already been explored today is LRT on the bridge. And the third question, or the third issue we'd like to address, is the whole issue of BRT, bus rapid transit on the bridge, and in addition to the UTA grant, which Mayor Rybeck spoke about. Very quickly, I could not be prouder of Metro Transit's response to the initial bridge collapse. Brian Lamb, the general manager of Metro Transit, and his team, I think, immediately put a plan in action to provide some degree of relief to those affected, particularly in the North Metro area. Initially, we added 25 buses immediately. 17 are dedicated to, were dedicated to express capacity, 8 dedicated to augmenting local service, and our initial focus was to provide or to utilize the 1,500 park and ride spots we have in the northern tier of the region. To date, we have spent about $210,000 on that effort. As the congressman mentioned a minute ago, the federal government has allocated $5 million of the relief money the Congress authorized, but is not appropriated yet for that purpose. We anticipate the annual cost of that service to be about $12 million. There's a whole host of questions that accompany that, of course. How much of that service will be retained after the bridge is constructed and the like. I would like to turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Lamb, now to provide a bit more detail on the particulars of our response, and then I want to very briefly address the LRT bridge issue and the BRT on the bridge. Mr. Lamb.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. For the record, I'm Brian Lamb, General Manager for Metro Transit. As Mr. Bell mentioned, right away, starting Thursday morning, we had 25 additional buses allocated in the North and East Metro in the effort to try to anticipate where we might see some increased demand. We followed that up with a kind of a three-tier plan that would allow us to continue to increase service as needed over the course of the next few months. We started out on Monday following the bridge collapse with a program that was geared towards providing access to park and ride lots where we had capacity. And so we ran a program that provided free service out of 12 targeted park and rides out of the in the North and East Metro. I'm pleased to say that right away we got a very demonstrable response that ridership in those 12 targeted areas, our 12 targeted park and rides, increased between 25 and 50%. After that first week, we've been monitoring and keeping additional service out there as needed. What's encouraging from my perspective is that the ridership, additional ridership that we noted right away that first week when we ran service, has held. And so it kind of reinforces a point that I continue to try to make, Mr. Chair, in that if we can get them on transit the first time, we believe that we can retain that kind of ridership. And to that end, even as last year transit ridership at Metro Transit increased 4 million over the previous year, we're on pace for increasing transit ridership above 4 million over this year over this past year. And that's despite the fact that gas prices have dipped and peaked during that period. So one of the things that we've talked about and we're planning for is not only a post-bridge collapse plan that would allow us to, as demand may shrink, but also optimistically, what are we going to do in terms of giving this a jump start in terms of transit enhancements and transit advantages in the North Metro and East Metro as we move forward? The mayor earlier mentioned that we are a recipient of a UPA grant that will allow us $133 million of federal dollars coming in to be matched. Basically the capital side 80-20 at the state or local level. And what we're planning in the North 35W as part of that grant proposal was to increase our park and ride capacity by 650 spots. And so planning continues to, so that we hopefully can build off of that behavioral change, that mode specific change that we're already seeing today, so that we can accommodate that into the future. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lamb. I'm sorry, Mr. Bell, you had some other statements to make.
Very, very quickly, one of the things that I would appreciate that the committee would take away is the cost of this. We anticipate the cost of all of our transit restructuring to be at about $16 million. Now, of course, that is dependent upon the period of time that the bridge is actually closed. If the bridge is closed for 12 months, the cost is different than if it's closed for 18 months or perhaps a longer, but that's an important part. And I would remind the committee that while we are very appreciative and proud that we were awarded the $133 million grant for the UPA, the Urban Partnership Agreement, that also will require a $26 million a match. And that's an important thing for the committee to consider. One other point of clarification that I would like to make, because I've received a number of inquiries about this, was the letter that the Lieutenant Governor and I sent to the Governor about LRT on the bridge. And the letter that the Lieutenant Governor and I sent regarding LRT on the bridge primarily focused on realignment of the Central Corridor. We expressed and I maintained that there would be severe challenges to restructure LRT on that corridor. As all of you are aware, we have entered into preliminary engineering on that project. We would have to perhaps do another alternatives analysis as well as other environmental studies, and virtually everyone who has weighed in on this acknowledges that that would push the project back anywhere from a year to 2 years. To the question of studying LRT on the bridge for a corridor other than the Central Corridor, that is something that we support. That is a separate decision, of course, than making the bridge LRT ready. But to look at
Mr. Bell, that's not exactly what the letter said, and that is under dispute. It was very unclear that you were trying to delineate between the two. It sounded like you were talking about light rail in general. And I think that's what got the hackles up on a lot of folks right away.
Chair Murphy, it is fair to say that I have some questions about should we proceed to put LRT on the bridge in terms of transit priorities that we have. I think, though, at the end of the day, Chair Murphy, that is a decision that the governor and individuals such as yourself and the respective committees represented here will decide. That is an independent question of studying it, though.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a separate question, of course, of the Central Corridor of being on the bridge. It is clear that the administration supports studying LRT. I think the governor has given indications that he is even open and receptive to making the bridge LRT ready. I think that is going to be predicated in part by what the studies show and the priorities that we have for our overall transit system.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Bell, I got two questions, one for you and then one for Mr. Lamb. This is in regards to the Central Corridor. I don't think that I've made my disdain for a full tunnel over at the university. I don't think that that's been in question. I don't think that that's the best use of our resources. I do believe that there are engineering there's engineering methods that can be used in that corridor so that we don't have to build a full tunnel and spend all that money. And I would hope that your agency is exploring those as vigorously as they're exploring the other options. I understand a lot of the concerns, and so do the committee members, that the university has. But this is a line that is not expressly the university's. I mean, it's the state's line. And we want to get the best light rail line that we can afford. And if we have to trim down the portion on the university side to meet the FTA requirements, I would hope that your agency can get that done.
Chair Murphy, a couple of points I'd make in response to your point and your concern. First, I am a strong, and I want to be totally unambiguous about this, I am a strong supporter of the Central Corridor. I'm a strong supporter of transit. I'm a strong supporter of rail transit. I think the Hiawatha Light Rail Line has been an unbelievable a success to this region. I want to build more of these lines. So I want to be very, very clear about that. It is my number one priority as chair of the Metropolitan Council. The factors that we have to consider, of course, is bringing the Central Corridor online in a cost that will allow us to secure matching dollars from the federal government. And the tunnel, believe me, Senator, will get very close scrutiny as if we can afford it and can we engineer in a way, if we don't do the tunnel, that can accommodate the legitimate, and I want to stress legitimate concerns that the university makes. But please, you have my assurance. We are looking at that issue very, very closely, as well as other options that have been well discussed and bantied about over the past month. But that is going to get a great deal of scrutiny. Please be assured of that.
Thank you. And Mr. Lamb, we spoke briefly right before the meeting. I don't know if you said it in your opening remarks, but it seems like that you are offering free bus rides. Is that correct for the first week or so after August 1st?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. We identified the park and rides. We had 12 park and rides with available capacity, and we tried to target free service out of that to introduce people to the availability of transit. And we did get, I think, a very strong response, as I noted earlier, between 25 and 50% increase in utilization in those 12 park and rides, and to my point is that after that first week, we've noted that the utilization has held steady. So we're very encouraged on that. That if we can get them on the first time, we can ultimately retain that transit ridership.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Before I ask my question, I did want to thank Mr. Lamb and Mr. Bell not only for your response, but how rapidly you sprung into action. I know that Mr. Bell and I, we spoke almost within a day or two of the tragedy, and I think even within an hour or two that night, you were planning for the next day. And you did a remarkable job, and really I just wanted to express my appreciation for that. You know, we've been talking, this is to Mr. Bell's third point about bus rapid transit, and my question is, what is your vision for this? Because, you know, we have a definition in state statute, actually, about what bus rapid transit should be. You know, frequent service, low platforms, expedited boarding, significant transit advantage. Have you given thought to not only the transit on the bridge, but what this BRT system along 35 North or whatever corridor you eventually choose going north from there would look like? Because we're not just building a bridge here, we're building a real system. And I'm interested in your thoughts, your vision for what this bus rapid transit is really going to look like, and again, the kinds of investments we're going to need to make in the transit infrastructure along and north of the bridge.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, first, thank you for those compliments. I want to be clear that the majority of the accolades should go to Mr. Lamb and his staff, because they really did, with no prodding from us, jump into action, and we were just kind of in the role of cheerleaders. So Mr. Lamb and his staff really deserve most of the praise and credit for that. Representative Hornstein, I think you're correct. Bus rapid transit is not a well-defined concept. It is somewhat in the eye of the beholder. And when we have said that the 35W bridge will have five lanes, one of those five in each direction will be an HOV lane and eligible for BRT, that is an open concept. We have not, to be more precise, given a great deal of thought of what it might look like. We have, as you are well aware, are doing our transportation policy plan update in 2008. That's the signature activity of the council. We'll be reassessing our Tier 1 and Tier 2 transit ways, and that would be something that is at or near the top of our list to look at what BRT might look like there. This whole process will be aided, however, by the UPA grant that I spoke about a minute ago. $133 million is coming. I think that we will be receiving about $90 million of that, and that is will allow us to put more park and rides in the northern part of the region, as well as express bus service. The extent to which that can be cobbled in or fashioned into a BRT system on the bridge is something that I'm very hopeful of, but a final determination has not been made as yet.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chairman Bell, on that point that you just talked about, my understanding on the UPA is that was designated for downtown, from south downtown Minneapolis down to Lakeville, and now you're talking about park and rides north of the city. How are you being able to apply that money in that to that degree? I thought it was just for South Metro.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dole, actually it was for both. We are going to have essentially congestion pricing from the southern suburbs all the way into downtown Minneapolis. So from Burnsville all the way to downtown Minneapolis, we're going to do some congestion pricing. From downtown Minneapolis to the southern suburbs, actually starting at 46th Street, we're going to have HOV lanes. That, crudely speaking, is what we'll be doing in the southern part of the region. In the northern part of the region is, as I just stated, we are going to have a great deal of additional express bus service as well as additional park and ride capacity. And really, the idea of the UPA is to look at those two strategies, compare and contrast those two strategies, and the strategies, those two strategies impact on congestion. But that was envisioned from the beginning. So we had always planned on doing something in the northern part of the region. It just is possible, I want to underscore possible, to dovetail that into a BRT type operation that we will now have the capacity to do on the bridge, with the major caveat of the bottleneck that Mayor Rybeck talked about. Going from five lanes to three lanes to four lanes creates a huge impediment for us. That's a very, very real concern.
On that point, to follow up, Mr. Chair, being that we have the road closed from basically 94 up to 280, and knowing that we have that bottleneck, mm-hmm. instead of just being the poster child for a bridge collapse, I think we want to be the poster child of how we respond to such a disaster. Is now the time to really look at reworking that roadway as well? And what would the, have you looked at into that, and what would the cost be if you have? I mean, what is the, looking at, did you look at the whole region and our transportation system, what have you been discussing on that level?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dole, I think it would make some sense to look at that, and of course, that's primarily a MnDOT decision, but we work very, very closely with MnDOT on this. I think my response would be to that question of fixing that bottleneck, which is a very real bottleneck. The mayor is absolutely correct about that. I would respond to that in a similar way that I'd respond to should we have BRT capacity on the bridge. It is an issue of priorities. And what else, how does that stack up against other priorities, both in the region as well as in the state? Do I think it's a problem? Absolutely. Do I think it should be corrected? Absolutely. Where it should fall in our overall priorities, however, is an open question.
Let's see, Representative Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Mr. Bell, you're taking 25 vehicles now out of your fleet. I don't know what your total fleet is, but that's a temporary thing, and I tell you, you're going to have a lot of pressures in the next year for buses. Are you leasing buses, or are you? How do you accommodate that? Can you use that $133 million part of that for capital for buses or not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leader, in answer to your question, you're right. It is a temporary solution. We have what we call a spare factor for buses in our regular fleet. Should any bus break down or need maintenance, we can fill in. So we have a temporary capacity right now. But these are tend to be buses that are at their 12th year of life with 400,000 miles already on their engines and that kind of thing. So we will need some additional equipment if we're going to maintain this for a period of time. Tonight we will be going to the Metropolitan Council with the authorization, with the hope for authorization to acquire some additional vehicles. And in answer to your question about the dollar amount that Chair Bell mentioned earlier, that did include the prorated portion of the capitalized equipment. So a bus, when we purchase it, typically lasts 12 years, and when we're talking about an annualized cost, we're taking essentially 1/12 of what that capital purchase would be when we're when those numbers are released.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I was wondering, I'll ask the same question of you as I mentioned before. Has the Met Council, have you ever talked about the Northwest Diagonal Line? I know we have the Northwest Corridor, the Cedar Corridor, Central Corridor, Red Rock, Southwest, and Rush Line Corridor. And the reason I ask that is because I had never heard that until, I guess, last month. Have you guys had meetings on the Northwest Diagonal Line?
Chair Murphy, Senator Day, I have, in anticipation of this question, a list of all the transitways we studied in that corridor. And we have looked at, over the years, since 1972, a number of transitways, but have not looked at rail directly. It's going over the 35W bridge. We looked at a subway system in 1972 going under the river. We've explored a number of different transit ways, but have not looked directly at a rail transit way. I asked this question as directly as I know how to ask it because I anticipated it coming up. We have not looked at a rail, an LRT line over the 35W bridge going back to 1972. So we have looked at, Mr. Chair and Senator Day, other transit ways, certainly in close vicinity and over that bridge.
Mm-hmm. Senator Day.
Mr. Chairman, and as I'm sure Mr. Bell and I have went round and round on different things in the past, I hope when the people put this all together that we don't make the same mistake we did with a Hiawatha line. Now, I realize that you're saying we have all this wonderful ridership. Number one, we don't even take tickets on it, so I've tried to figure out the numbers that you put forward, and I love mass transit. I wish we would have spent $700 or $800 million on a bus system. We would have had the finest system for mass transit as any city. And I'm really worried about the Central Corridor. And I'm worried about some of these lines that are going to cost so much, and that you're going to leave people out in communities that a bus could come nearby, and they're not going to be able to get to some of these things, and we're going to start putting all of our money in rail. And I hope we don't do that. And I know the ridership, you know, the ridership reminds me of the guy at a county fair, and I asked him, well, how do you know 200,000 people come to the county fair when you don't take tickets? And he said, well, we sold 50,000 cups of beer. I said, well, over the years we know so many people drink the beer, they go to the county fair.
you know, and I've tried to put the numbers together in the Hiawatha line, and I'm going to tell you, and I just don't have the time, but someday I'm going to do it. You can't transfer the people that you say you're transferring from buses to the light rail. I've rode it 7 times this year already, and I'm not a believer. And it's not helped congestion, and the Mall of America is the Mall of America. When you go there, you got all day. You can go there at 9 in the morning or 10 at night. But anyway, all I'm saying is, let's not leave people and take money from bus transit and move it into light rail. Because I really see something happening that there will be some rail lines, and then there will be these other people that are going to be sitting out here that won't be able to get to the rail line.
Senator Murphy, Senator Day, I appreciate your comments and your position. You and I have had a number of discussions about this and have respectfully agreed to disagree on the utility of rail. My only response is to your point of cannibalizing our bus operations by virtue of our rail operations. And I want to assure you that is not happening and not the case. Mr. Lamb and his staff continue to impress upon me and other council members that bus service is and will remain the workhorse of our entire transit system into the foreseeable future. People are very infatuated with rail. I'm a strong supporter of light rail. But the fact of the matter is there are many corridors that can only be served by bus or by BRT given the cost and the makeup of the region and the like. And we are not cannibalizing our bus system to provide rail, nor do we envision doing that anytime in the near future.
Thank you, Representative Earhart. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought I was listening to Swigum over there, but it's Senator Day.
I'm still against the gas tax, too.
Fine. Vote no. I have a question on the rail component would trigger new air quality and other environmental reviews. Adding additional costs to be raised to the project, which was in your letter. I think that's been cleared up now, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Dahl. I think that from what I've read of either the governor, from the governor's letter, or so many letters flying around, that environmental review was not necessary. Can anybody...
Representative Earhart, that is what the Fed said. As long as you use the same footprint on the bridge, you don't need that.
So we have established then, Mr. Chairman, that if we make that roof ready or light rail ready, that we would be okay, even though we didn't put the rail on it now. And aside from the central quarter question running across there, we can build that bridge with a light rail possibility in the future, and except for the extra money, we're okay with it. Am I understanding that correctly, Mr. Bell?
Senator Murphy, Representative Earhart, when we are talking about making the bridge LRT ready, it is technically possible, and it is my understanding that it would not trigger those additional environmental reviews. If, however, we wanted to reroute the central corridor to go over that bridge, that restructuring would trigger a different set of environmental considerations having to do with the central corridor, not necessarily having to do with the 35W bridge.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Bell. Senator Devil.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Forgive me if you said this and I missed it, but I haven't quite heard it. I don't quite have it in my head yet, but we haven't yet established how much it'll cost to make the bridge LRT ready. Okay. And do we know how soon we're going to know that? And, of course, what can we do to help the legislators to speed that up? Because, of course, we're very interested in the efficient planning, speeding up the planning so that we build a bridge as soon as we possibly can, but of course we want to build the bridge right. We've heard a lot of pressure now on Met Council that we didn't even anticipate or aware of as recently as last legislative session. Clearly, Met Council is is Metro Transit operations and capital are highly pressed already to meet demand and to fulfill the plans that we have on the drawing board. Where is all this money going to come from? I have some ideas, and I would ask for your help in that endeavor.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, I appreciate that question. As to the particulars of the bridge, both in terms of timing and cost, I can give some general responses, but frankly would defer to my MnDOT colleagues. My understanding is 25 to 30 million. An RFP has gone out asking for proposals that would include making the bridge light rail ready, and that I anticipate that those will be back and it would be possible to award a contract sometime around the mid-September timeframe. Now, beyond that, I would defer to my friends at MnDOT. In terms of your other question, I have the same concerns that you do. The transit budget is about $350 million. As you are very, very well aware, a transportation bill was not passed in the last session. As we prepare our calendar 08 budget, we are planning right now, subject to either a special session or a session, of course, the regular bonding session coming in early winter, we are going about $3 million into our reserves. That does not include the cost of responding to the bridge. That does not include the cost of the $26 million match for the UPA. That does not include the $280 million we're going to need for Central Corridor. Again, something that's a strong priority of mine, as well as other priorities. So we are pressed, and we're pressed at a time when ridership is at a 20-year high. As you well know, we have a goal of doubling ridership by 2020. I think that's, having to grow by 50% by 2020, doubling it by 2030. I think that's the right thing to do. I think we can do it. I think it's doable. I think it's doable in a fiscally responsible way. But right now, Senator Dibble, you are quite correct. Even with the phasing in of MVEST, which I know you were a strong supporter of, as was I, and its erratic performance, we have some very, very real challenges.
Thank you. We're going to let Senator Dibble ask one more question here, and then Representative Hausman to Mr. Bell, and then we're going to move along to Commissioner McLaughlin.
Thanks. Just a very quick follow-up. Thanks. That was very helpful, and like I said before, we're here to help, and so help us help you. I also don't believe that we need to cannibalize one part of the system to make sure we're doing another. And I would just simply echo, Senator Day and Representative Hornstein's earlier comments that, buses may be a good thing for this quarter. We studied the Northeast Diagonal as a busway. It may be a good place to start. But it really has to be the kind of bus service that people will get on and will ride. Replicate to the extent possible a rail experience, real bus rapid transit, not just an enhanced form of express bus that also gets bogged down in traffic. And at some point in the future, if it makes sense to do rail there, then that option is there. That's the model that other cities have used, and frankly now we have studies that show that, frankly, LRT is far more cost effective. You don't have the same kind of capital replacement costs you do over time, the same kind of operating costs. So I'd like to commend you for the flexibility and the creativity that you've shown, and as well as the governor. And again, let's come back to this issue of funding. The recent experience of the past is that we increased fares and slashed service, and that's a recipe for failure, and the region demands better.
Can I say amen?
That's good. Representative Hoffman.
Chair, I know there's been some ongoing confusion about the early letter and our discussion today. I gave away my map to Senator Day when he was asking the question of had you ever anticipated that corridor? Because, in fact, we have a map, your map, that shows that very corridor that you have on your long-range map. And my understanding is when we anticipate that, we don't anticipate mode. We think of corridor, but mode is determined much more closely to the time of construction when we do all that scientific study that determines what is the best. And so, though you have a corridor on there, we don't make any assumptions about what you might have thought might have passed through. That's one question. And the other is these UPA dollars, they clearly are going to become part of this discussion. And just to clarify, are they only to be spent on the 35W corridor, not all 35W, and only 35W, the UPA dollars? Both those questions.
Senator, Mr. Chair, Representative Houseman, a couple of responses, particularly to the study. As I understood the question, have we ever studied rail on the 35W bridge? And the answer is no.
This clarification, you tend not to make an assumption. You determine corridor, but you don't determine mode when you put together those maps. It sounds like...
Mr. Chair, Representative Houseman, that's correct. The typical standard format is to first look at a corridor that could generate additional transit ridership, then through the process of saying what's the best mode that would accommodate that in, that pent-up demand. Now, that has not always historically been the way that things have done. Going back a generation or two, they might have looked at things in a road or a mode specific way first and then determine whether it had viability. But I think the standard way is to go through the initial screening, if you will, to identify likely corridors, then do what they call as an alternatives analysis, which looks at the relative cost and benefits of each specific mode.
And then those UPA dollars, only for 35W or for 35W
and 35W and what?
For 35E. Is it only 35W?
Yeah. Just 35W.
All the UPA.
North and south. South, yes. It's the way I described it earlier to Senator Dole.
That's Senator Dahl. Senator Dole is...
I'm working my way up there.
Actually, one of my idols, but anyway. Seriously. It's where they laugh. Thank you, Mr. Dahl, Mr. Lamb. Commissioner, you're up next. Just so folks know, there's going to be a meeting from 5:30 to 9 today at the Central Library in downtown Minneapolis. That's at the corner of Hennepin and 4th Street in the Pollad Auditorium. This is to take public testimony on the 35W Bridge rebuild. All committee members are invited to be there and speak your mind if you wish.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I am Peter McLaughlin, Hennepin County Commissioner. I am joined in the audience by Commissioner Linda Koblick. I want to take this occasion to first thank the local jurisdictions that you represent, as well as the Met Council in the state, for the assistance that's been provided in response to the bridge collapse. It has been incredible, the amount of cooperation, whether it's the fire departments from all around the city of Minneapolis filling in, or the divers coming from half a dozen counties from across the state of Minnesota to help our sheriff's department in the diving operations, and then along with the federal folks and the naval people as well. So first I want to thank you and the local governments and other governmental units that you represent for that help. Secondly, I just want to quickly say the reason that this wasn't an accident, that the response that was made to this tragedy was as effective as it was. It was not an accident. In fact, viewed now by many as a textbook response to a disaster, and it happened because Hennepin County, the city of Minneapolis, other local jurisdictions had invested systematically in equipment that we needed ahead of time, from the 800 megahertz radios to other equipment, and we had it in place and ready to go. Second, while practice doesn't necessarily make perfect, it sure does help. And we had practice. We had practice with tabletop exercises. We had simulated disasters as well. And third, we had pre-existing protocols in place. We had chains of command in place. And so those were all, those could all be called upon in the response that we made. And I think, frankly, this methodical approach, systematic approach, is instructive for how we ought to be thinking about transportation as we move forward. And I just offer that along with my thanks again to you and others who have helped out. The Hennepin County Board yesterday passed a resolution on the topic of the 35W bridge replacement. We were very supportive of and applauded the efforts of the City of Minneapolis and MnDOT to work out the an agreement on municipal consent. There's been great progress made on that, and they're to be applauded for the work that they have done. I wanted to offer a few comments on behalf of the County Board. I think these comments all relate to this tension that exists between doing it quickly and a, what I would call a future orientation, a long-term orientation to the transportation system. I think all of my comments that were officially adopted here, the specific points that were made, I think relate to that point, and I wanted to frame it in that fashion. One, the County Board is supportive of the idea of building the bridge as LRT ready. We're talking about a bridge that's going to have a 100-year life. We need to be making these investments ahead of time. I would argue that we ought to be, and I've made this argument in front of the federal people as well, I think the fifth lanes that we're adding in each direction, which the federal government is saying they're going to pay for, I would say that making the bridge transit ready, LRT ready, it was analogous to adding a fifth lane for future capacity that's going to be needed. And I would hope that the federal government would see it our way and could see clear to pay for the incremental cost of making this bridge LRT ready. I think that the two are analogous to one another and ought to both be funded. I come here today, the three major roadways that are affected by this are University Avenue, 4th, and Washington Avenue. Those are all county roads, it turns out. And so we have specific positions relating to that. We are very supportive of the accommodation of a future separate project that would extend the fourth lane in each direction north from University Avenue, the bottleneck that Mayor Rybak mentioned, while minimizing the impacts on University Avenue and 4th, both of which are county roads. We want to make sure, and MnDOT's been working with us to make sure that the profile of the bridge isn't such that we're going to have to build a new bridge on one or both of these county roads, which would be expensive. We think that we can do that. And we also think that providing this capacity is important, and I can say that I've been in meetings and conversations with officials from local governments north of the city of Minneapolis along this corridor who are very concerned about that need for extra capacity, that fourth lane to the north of University and 4th. We also are supportive of improving the existing and future freeway access to Washington Avenue on the south side of the bridge. Again, a county road. If any of you have tried to leave downtown Minneapolis during rush hour northbound on the 35W, it backs up today. It backs up, it's been backing up for the last 10 years, and it ought to be fixed. And there have been plans that have been proposed for connecting it to 3rd and 4th Streets. We think that those are appropriate plans, and the fact that those are going to be accommodated, we think that's important in the design of the bridge. While saying at the same time, however, that we should maintain that access off of Washington Avenue. That's important for the development that's been occurring along Washington Avenue, for the Seven Corners Theater District and neighborhood, and also for the University of Minnesota, which the students, faculty, and staff, many of them use that access point off of Washington Avenue. We also are very supportive, Mr. Chairman, of inclusion of the width needed to provide the bus rapid transit and to incorporate the strategies that are part of this urban partnership agreement. So we wanted to go on record on these things. I think the tension between doing it quickly and having a future orientation, I think it's a little bit like walking and chewing gum at the same time. I think we can do it, and we ought to try to do it, and it's not that hard to do. But we need to make sure that as we're providing direction to the design builders, that we give them the direction to make sure, and that the planners at MnDOT and the Met Council and elsewhere actually have that notion that we can do it quickly, but also provide this future orientation, because we don't put a bridge across the Mississippi River very often, and we ought to do it
do it right.
The other concern I wanted to raise, Mr. Chairman, and this was explicitly noted in our resolution by the county board yesterday, we want to make sure that funding for these projects that have been identified is not going to disrupt other priorities around the county and around the region. It is important that we not be allowing this to just jump the queue. And my view is this. We're at a historic moment here. It's a moment for reflection. It's a moment for reassessment. And it's a moment for recommitment to the vision and the practice that we had in the state of Minnesota long term of making investment in our infrastructure to allow our economy to prosper and our communities to grow. That's the historic moment that we're at. And while I agree with Mr. Bell that it's an issue of priority, it's also an issue of resource. And I think that needs to be tackled and tackled directly. There's always going to be an issue of priority. But there is a need, a crying need, and I think that's the tragedy here, as I think should be clearing up our eyesight and clearing up our vision for the future, that there is in fact a need for additional resources in order to move forward. I'd be happy to stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Questions for the commissioners? Well, you're so good. Nobody even asked questions.
Like that,
you've intimidated everybody. No.
It's getting to be late. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, Commissioner. Next, if we could have the folks from MnDOT that we had the other day that were here, Mr. Chigolo and Mr. Sahijam. I think I'm starting to get it right, but who knows. And then Mr. I believe it's Pasco from the Environmental Services for MnDOT. Because there were plenty of questions that were left over from the other day. And first, who's Mr. Sahijam? Do you want to kind of fill us in on what's transpired over the last week first, and then we can go from there?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'll start it off, and then I'll hand it off to some of our folks here, as you mentioned.
Okay.
Again, my name is Connie Sahijam, and for streamlining purposes, you can call me Connie or Mr. Connie if you like. So to make it easy for members of the committee. As we left the last meeting that we had and all the questions that were posed to us, it became very clear that although we are close to the process and it seems like, you know, we're sure everything is going to work out, we're going to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. But we realize there's a lot of questions in the minds of folks not so close to the process, and members of this committee and the public. And questions came to us whether we're moving too fast and so on. And when I look at that picture right behind you, I think it makes it very valid that you have questions and you have concerns. And it's very hard to come move ahead of things and say, yeah, we're in charge, we'll handle this one, but then there's a big pit in the bottom of the river. So I think it is our job to communicate what we're doing, and I'm finding out communication is very becomes very difficult, especially if we're talking about technical terms and things like that. So we have accumulated a lot of the questions that you posed to us, and there was all the responses was put together, and I believe everybody has a packet that has all the questions answered that you had asked, and we are here to answer further questions. The three themes that I remember from last meeting, one was partnership and inclusion of other agencies. One has to do with the environment and what we're doing with the environmental process, and one has to do with design build. And we will respond to all of those in general terms here with the folks at the table with me, and you also have responses in your packages. I want to mention one little mini story about how what happened to me when I heard this. And I think as I was driving from home to the office, all these things going through my head. Now what are you going to do? Now what are you going to do? And the very first person I talked to, and it wasn't planned, and I just did it by instinct. I called up my colleague at the City of Minneapolis, Steve Kotsky, the Public Works Director, and I saw him earlier. I don't know if he's here or not, but that's here. To me, I'll pat myself on the back by saying that's at my level, at the staff level, that shows partnership, and I didn't even talk to my own staff. I talked to him first because it's in his city, and that's the gentleman I have lunch with occasionally and meet with on transportation issues. So I wanted to say that. And I, as you've noticed, at all levels, there has been plenty of partnership and discussion about this project and how we're going forward. We have also set up the questions last time. Senator Dibble was asking about public hearings and things like that, and we've had some, and we have scheduled 3 or 4 more next week, and we can tell you about those if you'd like to include as many people as possible. The next, and then as Mayor Ryback mentioned, we have submitted the layout as part of the process to the City of Minneapolis yesterday. A letter and a layout went out, and we have a copy of it here, and it does include LRT, so LRT design. I think he also mentioned that there's a public hearing set up for September 20th, I believe. We will be part of that to help the city out. And between now and then, there will be plenty of meetings with the council members and other interested parties. The next two main themes that we would like to respond to, and I have with me Frank Pasco. He's the Office Director for Environmental Services, and he'll first address the whole environmental process. There's questions whether we're bypassing, whether we're streamlining. The different parts of the operation. You have the bridge removal that needs environmental approvals, the traffic restoration projects we're doing around town, those need federal approvals, and of course the new bridge. So he will explain that for us, and then after Frank, John Chigalo, who you've met last time, will talk about the process of the procurement process of the design build team. So with that, I'll pass it over to Frank.
Mr. Pasco.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Frank Pasco. I'm Director of MnDOT's Office of Environmental Services. Purpose today is to address questions regarding the environmental review and issues that were raised during last week's hearing. First, and this I know has been discussed in the question and answers here today, does inclusion of a light rail transit component into the project due to the environmental process? There's a very keen distinction here. Adding an LRT line to the bridge replacement ties the bridge replacement project to the environmental process of that line. However, adding strengthening the bridge structurally to hold the weight of an LRT time in the future does not change the environmental process at all that we have done today. Second, I think there was a question about the public involvement process. And we have met and exceeded the requirements of law and regulation, as we routinely do in many process of public involvement. And adding this additional public involvement does not trigger additional environmental review. Finally, the status of the environmental process and the environmental permit on the entire process, not just the bridge replacement process, but the recovery and the demolition debris, the new bridge, and the recovery of traffic. I'm not going to go into great detail. That is found in the letter that we sent to Senator Murphy and Representative Leiter on page 6 and 7. What I do want to, and you can look those over and I'll be prepared to answer any questions you have, but what I do want to state is that the environmental process and these permits were not waived or ignored during any of the activities on any of these three groups of projects. the environmental review process was expedited. It was using procedures that we have in existing law and regulation. It was expedited using streamlining measures that other state agencies and ourselves have instituted over the years to try to streamline the process for all projects. It was expedited because of the outstanding relationships we have with a lot of the environmental review and resource agencies. And an awful lot of adrenaline, caffeine, but mostly the overwhelming desire of everyone we dealt with to help respond to the collapse of the 35 bridge. I just cannot say enough how incredible this support was from all the agencies. Let me give you a couple of examples. Thursday morning, staff biologist from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service calls us and starts the endangered species coordination. Our DNR liaison started working on the permit requirements for and coordination internally with DNR without being asked. We have procedures in law and regulation that gives the State Historic Preservation Officer 30 days to review our preliminary finding from the Federal Highway Administration, or give, and they turn that around in a day for us. Existing regulation gives both the Minnesota tribes and any Native American tribes outside the state that have an interest in Minnesota up to 35 days to review a federal project for any of their concerns. The most time any of those tribes took to respond back to us was 24 hours, and most of that included words of condolence and encouragement for us to go forward. Dealing with the Pollution Control Agency, in particular on some of our recovery of traffic, we converted Highway 280 that night into a freeway. We had some access issues that had to be solved that day. We knew we had some from past work, we knew we had some contamination issues. They pulled their files out of archives in a couple of hours on Thursday. You ever try to get anything out of the state archives in less than a month? I know I'm missing folks. The National Park Service, the Mississippi River Watershed Management Organization, Minneapolis Park Board, City. Everybody we dealt with dropped everything and expedited this process to get it done. And it was just an incredible experience. With that, any questions?
Senator Dole, you had a question for I'm going to have to have a talk to Mr. Bell. Question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to follow up on what Chair Bell had responded about this part of the highway 35W and the priority levels. If we're going to rebuild a bridge that has five lanes and capacity for BRT, and as I think you testified last week, Mr. Chigwell, about looking out 20 years and congestion levels, and we're not dealing with the bottleneck north of that, the bridge and south of the bridge, what is holding us back from dealing with that? Well, how can we move that priority level up? Now that that section of road is closed, knowing that's one of the biggest obstacles faced with these reconstruction projects and the costs involved, what's going to hold us back from dealing with that issue right now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dahl, the bottleneck, the project we have now, even though it includes about 75% additional bridge deck, an additional auxiliary lane in each direction, LRT capable, is a bridge replacement project that can move forward literally immediately. Solving bottleneck issues also can move quickly, but as standalone projects. The bridge replacement projects can move ahead, and we can start to study what it will take, and under a separate environmental process, start looking at those bottleneck removal projects.
So what you're saying is you'll take that on as another project after we get the bridge built?
Senator, we can do the study of the bottleneck project concurrent with the construction reconstruction of the existing bridge. We do not have to wait for the completion.
All right. Thank you.
Representative Halston.
to say to Mr. Chair, mine are sort of left over from last week. I was that last one on the list, and so they have to do with kind of financing and design that,
okay.
that the two gentlemen raised last week. There's a 2005 Twin Cities Transportation System Performance Audit, and there's a paragraph that says, the metropolitan area's bridges do not quite meet all the targets established in MnDOT's state plan. The state bridge system does meet the target for the combined fair and poor condition, and normally one wouldn't want to advertise that you meet the target for fair and poor. But then the concluding sentence is, the MnDOT Metro District Plan is allocating resources to fully meet the bridge performance targets by the year 2023. And I think last week we were trying to get a handle on, you know, if we're responding to a crisis, what are all the other issues? And when you read that to fully meet the bridge performance targets that the department has established, we're allocating resources to do that by the year 2023, which I think for the average member of the public would be confusing.
I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Haldeman, the question, I think as we replace, we have bridges that become deficient as we move on, and the question becomes how quickly we can get to all the projects. So I think you have to have a plan to replace and bring the bridges within the performance measure, the target that you have, but it's difficult to do it all at one time.
And, you know, I think it's important to say that when I ask any of these questions, MnDOT engineers and employees are not the ones that we're questioning, because MnDOT engineers and employees can only ask for what the governor allows them to ask for, and they can only spend what the legislature appropriates. So I don't mean to in any way suggest that there is sort of culpability by employees. But
Representative Hausman, I believe that the commissioner is going to be asked to answer a few questions here in a little bit. Maybe those questions would be more appropriate for the
commissioner. Can I just ask a design one?
Yes.
This was an article that Representative Kahn distributed from Press Ideas and Better Steel Paper Bridges. And there's a paragraph that describes the Silver Bridge over the Ohio River, which was the deadliest failure. And it talks about the biggest risk for bridges turned out not to be innovation, but aging and increasing loads. And they specify, the span had been designed for Model 2 Fords, but the weight of automobiles had more than tripled in the ensuing decades. And I think the other question that maybe an average member of the public would wonder, we always talk about we're designing this for 100 years from now, how do you anticipate that kind of future change in a way that assures people that we really know what we mean when we say we're building a 100-year bridge?
Mr. Chair, Representative, being a former bridge engineer, maybe I'll try to tackle it. We do have our state bridge engineer here that can add to it, too. We always, as you know, design to current standards, and there's some assumptions made based on weight of trucks and number of cars and so on. And as bridges get older, there is a process called bridge rating where you go through, and both the local agencies do that, the counties, the cities, and the state. They look at what the bridges can handle now. As they're seeing, for example, can this bridge handle a milk truck out in the township road somewhere? And so they go through a process and rate. They look at every critical portions of the bridge and rate and determine what kind of load capacity it has. So if it cannot handle the current load capacity, the type of vehicles that go over it, then the bridge will be posted for that.
Mm-hmm.
So we will never allow any weight higher than what the bridge can handle over the structure. And if I may, the great success story here in Minnesota about, you were talking about bridge funding and bridge program, and that my former job was with the state aid division, which I worked for the local agencies to help them get bridge funding, and that's been a great success. I think you folks obviously have a lot to do with that, appropriating dollars every couple of years, $30 to $40 million, to help with the local, with our local bridges, and I think it's a model that we have, and a lot of people can take credit for that. And I think my boss, the current commissioner, used to be in the legislature, and she was very supportive of that program. So, so we do a lot of good things here in Minnesota.
Thank you. I think before we take any more questions, we need to get Mr. Chigalow's testimony on the record, if you have some prepared statements, because we've got most of our transit subcommittee members are going to be shoving off for Minneapolis, and well, we want to make sure they get there on time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's two things I would like to talk about today. One is design build. More of a discussion on the reason why we're using design build, and the other is communications and public involvement process that we'll be using as we move forward. As you are well aware, MnDOT had decided to use design build to deliver this project, and MnDOT's expectations for this project are that we deliver a project that has a high degree of quality in a safe manner, and that is cost effective. And those are our goals. Design build provides a number of advantages for completing the project earlier than a traditional process. And one of those advantages is that it does overlap the design and construction aspects of the project. It pushes or requires the contractor to take on responsibilities associated with development of the design. It requires the contractor to take on responsibilities associated with the quality of construction. It has a higher degree of contractor responsibility as far as inspection, plan review, and in those aspects, we also believe that in the end, design build provides a lower probability for cost overruns in as far as the overall project cost. MnDOT has awarded numerous projects over the last 6 years that have been design build. Highway 52 or Rock 52 in Rochester is one of them. Highway 212 in Southwest Metro is another. The 494 design build is a third. The Highway 52 project that's currently being constructed in Rochester and Orinoco is the fourth. And there's the 1032 interchange reconstruction in Hawley. Many of these projects were completed in record time, which far exceeded the expectations of MnDOT and what we expected as far as the time frame of construction. For example, Rock 52 was completed approximately 2 years ahead of what we had originally anticipated as a 5-year construction timeline, and in some aspects, because of the budgetary constraints, it was looked at as almost a 10-year or 12-year project. MnDOT is recognized as a national leader in respect to design build. We've won numerous awards recognizing the achievements of our projects. The Design Build Institute of America has recognized MnDOT as the 2007 Owner of the Year. The Design Build Institute of America has also recognized Rock 52 with the 2006 Merit Award for Transportation Projects over $50 million. Rock 52 also was the winner of the 2006 Association of Public Work Officials Project of the Year. Roads and Bridges magazine recognized the I-494 project as their 2005 Project of the Year. Highway 212 has recently won two awards, one being the Association of Highway and State Transportation Officials Value Engineering Award, and it also won the Federal Highway Administration Utility Coordination Process. So there's been a lot of achievements that MnDOT has had as far as design build in our delivery. It's recognized nationally. Design build also would allow MnDOT to execute contracts within weeks instead of months in waiting for the design to be developed under a standard process. This also would allow a large value of savings in road user costs and economic advantages. Only the highest quality contractors and designers are being allowed to procure or proceed in moving forward and trying to win this project through our request for qualifications and our qualifications process. The contract will be awarded to the contractor who can provide the best combination of a number of different criteria, one being quality, the experience and authorization of the personnel that each team is bringing to the project, their quality program, their safety and performance measures are also going to be evaluated as part of this process. The geometric and the bridge concepts that they are providing us will be a part of the evaluation process. Their approach to communication relating to the experience of their public relations coordinator, the approach to minimize an impact to nearby residents is also going to be part of our evaluation. The aesthetics is also going to be looked at as part of the evaluation process, and the approach and commitment to involving stakeholders in the design process. That is something that we are working very closely with the city on. We are having three public meetings starting next week to start getting that public involvement and input, and we will be inviting each of the five teams, to not really participate but attend and gain and gather input from the residents as this process moves forward. We would expect them to take that input and use it as part of their development of their technical proposal, which will be evaluated by a number of individuals, which will have involvement from the city, the county, and a context-sensitive design group that we've developed to develop important principles that need to be established and maintained as this project's constructed. MnDOT will work to continue to work the cooperation of these agencies, as Frank and Connie had mentioned, and we'll continue to work with the city and county and many other interested groups in gathering their input and as this project moves forward.
Thank you. Senator, let's see, we've got 7 folks that want to ask questions. Senator Bonoff and then Representative Morgan.
Chair Murphy, I believe my question would be best answered by either the Deputy Commissioner or the Commissioner. So do you want me to ask the question as a follow-up from the last session, or would you rather I wait?
Why don't we wait on any questions for the top tier?
Thank you.
Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, I appreciate your answer to Senator Dahl's question earlier. But in light of the fact that we've heard testimony today from Mayor Rybak, Commissioner McLaughlin, and Chairman Bell, that they are concerned about the bottleneck heading northbound in particular over this bridge, I think, as a legislature, would like to know, and I agree with Senator Dahl, that while that road is shut down anyway, would be a fantastic time without causing further delays to the traveling commuting public. Getting that bottleneck taken care of. So when could you provide for us an estimate of the cost to relieve that problem immediately north of the bridge?
I don't know if we've looked at the, Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't think we've looked at the full fix. I think we've been working with the city on what the ultimate fix is there. I think the big questions are real simple. How much is it going to cost, and what is the fix? And we are doing our best to incorporate the future design as part of this contract right now. I think we all have a goal, I assume, to build this bridge as soon as we can, and we're working that to that direction. So. And as Mr. Pascoe said, the process for those two projects can start while this project is under construction. What's going to be difficult with this current contract, as John Chigalow can tell you, is it's going to cost money to change the contract in the middle of construction and add things to it. And that's the exact type of thing that we don't want to do and, we'll do our best what we can to include it into a future project, and And again, I don't know if those specific projects were anywhere in our plan to be done in our metro plan. I don't think it was. But we need to see where that fits into our process. And I totally agree with you that when the road is closed, that's the time to do it. But we just got to figure out how that's going to happen.
Well, we've got about 12 months to figure that out and make it happen. We've got Senator Dibble and Representative Earhart.
Great. Thanks. And thanks to Mr. Chiglow for going through the public input piece. Sounds like there's been a lot of thought about that in the intervening week, and I appreciate that. As you know, that was a keen concern of mine last week, and it felt like Mr. Heapjohn's point, it's hard to change once we've let a contract, and we were extremely concerned that contracts were about to be let and things were getting finalized before there was much opportunity for input. So to that end, Representative Hornstein and I have scheduled a hearing tonight to give folks, in a more centralized location, a natural forum, a format for folks to come, set by not an open house type of setting, but to come forward and speak in a public setting. People feel a real desire to do that, or if they're shy, they can of course submit their comments in writing. We'll accept that as well. So we're going to transmit those to you under official cover, and we hope that you take those comments that we receive at the public hearing tonight to heart as well. But we of course are glad that the coming weeks we'll see more opportunity for folks to plug in and have some input into the design. My question is, again, relating to the design and what is shaping up to be fairly strong public consensus that this bridge be ready for the future and be ready to receive a train. We talked about this, the structure underneath to support sufficient weight for what might end up being an LRT or some sort of rail facility. But is the bridge going to be wide enough to as it's currently conceived or as we're talking about now, or can we add to the width sufficiently? We talked about the BRT, mixed-use HOV BRT lane. Is that where we envision? I mean, I don't want to set anything in stone. What my real question is, if we widen the bridge or make the bridge slightly wider, does that trigger the kind of environmental reviews that we're all trying to avoid?
And how
does that square with, we're already making it wider? I mean, if the answer is yes, we're already making it wider. But if we do trigger more environmental scrutiny.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'd ask, could you just clarify what wider for the use of LRT?
Correct, yeah. Yeah. I mean, is what we're envisioning now sufficient to accommodate LRT, or are we talking about potential? I know we're talking about strength and footprint, now bridge deck width. Does that trigger the kind of, god awful in 18 months or 2 years that we're trying to avoid?
Mr. Chair, in your packet, there's what we call a typical section that shows, yes. And on the top, mm-hmm. typical section shows where LRT would be accommodated. The middle one shows where BRT would be accommodated. And then the lower one shows the bridge width that would be constructed under this contract. So you can see how each of those would be accommodated in that typical section. And we wouldn't have to add any width.
Thank you.
Okay, we have Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think this is one left over from last week, and it was Mr. Kinsey. I think we were talking about 12 projects that are going to be deferred because of the traffic congestion problems created by the bridge going down. Can you tell us or give us a list of the projects that you're going to defer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, I don't know if I have the list of projects here, but there are some projects that, because the elimination of the bridge, this bridge being in the river, it's going to push cars onto other roads. We feel we need to keep those roads open. There's a list in your packet here. On page 10, item 20 lists the project.
Okay. Well, if it's in the packet, Mr. Chairman, that's fine. I remembered her talking about it last week, but I don't remember that anybody referred to it. Mm-hmm.
Well, Representative Earhart, I think the questions you're getting to, and maybe the commissioner will be able to ask this or answer this, but in the maybe we'll just wait for the commissioner to take that. We've got Senator Jungbauer and then Representative Leader. Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I need a little more clarification on the design build, and I work with design builds all the time at our business. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem that concerns me on this particular project in design build, when we're bidding a project under design build, we never know who we're bidding against, what we're bidding against, and in terms of general construction, there's a lot of ways to meet code, a lot of ways to meet engineering, and how do we know, it sounds like you've thought through a lot of this process, but how do we know we are getting the best quality product, and we're not just looking at the bid? I mean, I hear a lot of things, but it really didn't get to the meat of the structure itself. I just would like some more assurances that we're looking at the structure itself as the primary focus, and some of these other things are very secondary.
I have a good answer, but John has a better answer. I'll let him
answer. Mr. Chair, part of the design build program within MnDOT, we've established what you would call a template. And within that template, we've established program requirements or program specifications that have been modified to modified from our state standards to accommodate design build. It's an extensive template that establishes minimum expectations based on our state standards. And we have traditionally in our state standards we have preferred and minimum standards. In general, what we have required the contractor to do is meet those preferred standards, which are higher than what our minimum standards are. If it's if it's shoulder width or lane width or what that may be, or different standards, we have preferred and minimums, and we're requiring them to meet that higher the two standards within our state standards: roadway, geometric, hydraulics, etc. So we have established our criteria, like you mentioned. There's flexibility in the design build process to allow the contractor to develop their bid, but we're very confident in this template that we've established. It's been used on multiple jobs now, and those standards, like I said, are a preferred standard.
Mr. Chigalow, in regards to the design build, and somebody told the governor that there were no issues with design build on the Rock 52 project, which isn't true. There were some issues, very minor, but there were some hiccups along the road. I would hope that the information that's being passed up the chain of command is exact, and I think that if you talk to former Senator Sheila Kiskaden, she can probably fill you in on a lot of the acquisition, you know, property acquisition fiasco that happened down there, and some of the water runoff, curb and gutter issues that were kind of cleaned up afterwards. Like I said, those are very minimal, but there were some issues with design build. And members, the MGM Grand Hotel, where 82 people burned to death. That was a design build hotel. So we do have, you know, there still are examples of design build out there, and then there's other tragedies that have happened. Could it have occurred whether it was a standard design and then bid and then build project? Exactly. I mean, we've got the Wakota Bridge to, I mean, we can look at that and say, well, I guess it could happen either way. But when you say design build, a lot of people remember some of these things, and that's why, you know, the hair on the back of our neck sometimes stands up. We want to make sure that we have the preferred standard, and any minimal standards are far exceeded. So.
Mr. Chair.
Mm-hmm. Senator Jungbauer.
Quick follow-up. If you had an answer to that, you could do that first. But
Mr. Chair, I was involved in the Route 52 project, as you are aware. Mm-hmm. I'm aware of the right-of-way issues. I don't think that those issues are specific to design-build, however. Those are issues that we have on many of our projects. But it was, I don't believe that those issues, if it's drainage or right-of-way or whatever they may have been that I'm aware of, I don't believe they're specific to design-build. And to just make another comment, I would guess that the majority of the buildings in downtown Minneapolis, any schools that are being built, are using design-build right now to build those schools. So I don't think that if there's accidents that have occurred, I think you got to look deeper into the details. The devil is in the details.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're very confident that the standards that we're using within design-build are preferred standards. They're not minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm all of a sudden.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chigwell, I guess within MnDOT's way of doing it, and something that I always think is missing from the general contractor version of design-build is let's just take an example on a bridge. If you decided to use steel girders versus cement girders, is there a provision in there where the contractor in his bid could justify and say, this is why we went with this kind of design, so that you'd have a little bit more free play in looking at it and deciding if that serves a long-term purpose, or somebody else could come along and say, yeah, I think this would be the better design based on their justification of that. I know that's missing from the real world out there, so if you're doing something that gives the customer a more long-term appeal on his building, a better value that way, you never get a chance to justify it. So again, you don't know what you're bidding against. I'm wondering if you guys have put some provision for that in your process.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I think we're looking at the total bridge and how that entire bridge is performing, and I think that the parameters that we've established and our expectations as far as the criteria is going, it will require that high degree of quality to be implemented into the design and the construction, regardless of the structure type. And I guess there's a lot of different criteria that we're looking at as far as the deck of the bridge, not just the beams or the girders. So there's a lot of different criteria that's taken into account when those things are selected by the contractor, but we are comfortable with the criteria we're establishing that there will be a high degree of quality, irregardless if it's steel or concrete.
Thank you. We've got four more questions here for this panel. Representative Leader, then Representative Madure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Mr. Chigolo, how do the... I think we have in state statute there's a warranty built in, is that correct? And also, how does the state accept the project? Is that on the certification from the contractor?
Okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Leader, the state statute, I don't believe, requires a warranty, but we do have a warranty as part of the project. It's a three-year warranty. It deals with materials and workmanship aspects of the project. And your second question had to do with, the contractor is required to certify a number of different aspects of this, that it's been built in accordance with the state standard specifications, and that, yes, they are required to provide certification.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Chigolo, that's, I believe, so in other words, the contractor does all the inspection, and we only have one or two state inspectors as oversight. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, no, that is not correct. We will have an extensive MnDOT verification team that will perform verification inspection. We will have many more people than one or two. I expect to have MnDOT inspectors or inspectors representing MnDOT managing and overseeing the construction and design of this effort on all the shifts that are going to be that will be worked on. Now, on 212, just to give you an example, we had close to 30 people working on that job representing MnDOT, and those people helped with design review, and inspection, construction inspection. So, there will definitely be more than one or two people.
Mr. Chair, is that normal, Mr. Chigalow? Normally, the contractor, aren't they doing the inspection, the physical inspection? You're doing the oversight, but they're doing the inspection?
Mr. Chair, they do have a role as far as inspection, yes. But MnDOT also has the responsibility for verification of that work, and that we run tests, we do testing of materials, and we also have inspection responsibilities. And one thing that the design build has really brought to MnDOT is what we call hold points. So we identify critical aspects of that construction that we require the contractor to stop at and allow us to do an inspection prior to them to proceed, to allow us to verify that the work has been done in accordance with those plans. That's something that Design Build has really introduced to the state, and that's something that we'll be using on this project.
Mr. Chigalow, is that also customary in regular projects, pretty much?
Mr. Chair, I don't think it's as formal of a process as it is on Design Build on our regular project. And I think it's more... it's an ongoing process where MnDOT does those inspections, but we have formalized it as part of our inspection process on design build.
Representative Medora and then Senator Carlson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Actually, I'd like to speak to this list that we received on the projects that are remaining for 2008, so I guess this deals with the fiscal. Do you want me to hold off asking that?
Yeah, if you would. I don't think that the gentlemen that are at the table are the appropriate folks. I've got several questions, too, about the $1 billion of bridge work that needs to be done in the state. So.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson?
Mr. Chair, and Connie or Mr. Chigalow, I'd like to get a feel from you, just an answer on the net present value. What we're talking about here, what Senator Dahl was asking, was what's the advantage of doing approach work right now? We've already talked about the vision that it takes to recognize that someday there's going to be LRT needed on this bridge. But what we're talking about also is the nature of having to shut down traffic to fix something that we're anticipating in the future. That is the change of the approach, the getting rid of some bottlenecks. And in other projects, for instance, the 494 bridge or the bridge that goes across the St. Croix over by Hudson, there's a major portion of the cost of that's involved in traffic management. When you have an open bridge, you have to pave new areas that are going to be torn up. You have to put in signaling. You have to have flag people. You have to all sorts of costs like that. And what we can do is we can ignore a lot of that by doing something today because there's no traffic there. And I'm wondering if you have a rule of thumb or if you have some kind of figure or something that can give us the present value of that, of trying to avoid that in the future by doing this work now.
Mr. Chair, the one thing I would say is that because we are able to avoid that in this circumstance is one of the reasons why we were able to build this in the time frame that we're anticipating building it in. And so there is a large value to the road user in trying to avoid that. And I think Connie expressed that concern earlier. I think the question has been raised, what do we need to do to get this done as quickly as possible on the north end? I think there's a lot of variables, though. I think, I've managed some large projects, and I've never seen anything like we've had in the last 3 weeks, where people have come to the table with a common goal and work to achieve that common goal in the time frame that we were able to achieve it. And I think in order to get this interchange at University and Fourth done in a timely manner, you're going to have all those folks coming to the table with that common goal also and put those issues on the table and have a very frank and honest discussion. Without that, it's going to linger on many, many months. It may be many, many years. There's a transit aspect. There's a highway aspect. There's a city and county aspect that all need to come to the table with that common goal in order to achieve that. And that is not an easy thing to happen and to have have done. So I don't know if I can give a present value to you, sir, for being able to build this without traffic right now, but there is definitely a value to it, and I would say it's substantial. But in order for that to happen, you got to have that common goal.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chigalo. We're going to take Representative Hornstein, Morrow, and then Solberg, you guys. So not Solberg? Okay. Looks like the House has beat us down again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question concerning this, the public involvement process as it relates to the municipal consent hearings that will commence on September 20th. What are some of the critical decisions that you need to make prior to that? And is there a little bit of a disconnect in terms of making those decisions prior to the formal public process that will commence on September 20th?
Mr. Chair, the one I kind of rushed through my discussion at the beginning. I was gonna touch on this. MnDOT has developed, along with the city and the county, developed a context-sensitive design group to discuss the aesthetic features of this project and how, as this bridge is developed and constructed, how we ensure that the important principles as far as aesthetics or qualities of this corridor are not compromised when we design and construct this bridge. And, you know, as part of that process, we've involved a number of groups. The city is part of this group. The National Park Service is part of this group. The Park Board is part of this group. Friends of the Mississippi River are part of this group, among others. And we are working with them to try to develop some guidelines for the contractor to develop their proposal with them. As part of this, these meetings that we will be holding next week and the following week, we will be asking for public input on those types of things. And we will be not requiring the contractor per se to actively participate, but we will be requiring them to attend these meetings and gain input or gather input for their proposal development. So as this process moves on, that's how we would be anticipating gaining public input on the each team's proposal. We would also then have one of the members of this context-sensitive group as part of a technical advisory group for the panel that is evaluating the technical proposals. That will, again, gain valuable insight as to the proposers that, and their technical proposals. That person then will be able to look at each of the team's final submittal for aesthetics and give those evaluators some insight. There are a great deal of points as far as the technical score will be applied to aesthetics, more than we probably ever had on this on a design build job, more than Rochester, which is probably the heaviest for aesthetic value. But those points are a great deal of influence on these contractors. Each point, for instance, is worth 1% of the estimate of the contract. So, we're applying, I believe, 15 points to this evaluation criteria to really encourage create an incentive for these contractors to pursue the aesthetics and point out how important aesthetics are to this bridge. And so there's a number of parameters that we'll be using. Now, the last thing is, because we have five teams proposing on this project, we pay, under the legislation, we pay a stipend. And these teams will be asked, if they accept the stipend, the ideas within their technical proposal will become the property of MnDOT or the partners of this project. And we can then incorporate ideas from those four unsuccessful teams into that final proposal plan set. And so there's not only public input, but there's five independent approaches to how this bridge should look aesthetically and fit within the context-sensitive design principles that we can take from and create, I would believe, a very substantial bridge.
Thank you. So do you have a due date for this RFP yet then established?
At this time, we're anticipating the week around the 17th of September.
So you have a due date prior to the public hearing on the 20th? Is that
at this time, yes.
Yeah, that's concerning, but we can move on to some other things. Mm-hmm.
Well, we can still talk about those things along the way. And Representative Hornstein, just so you know, kind of, I think there's a lot of people, and not just around this table, but, you know, statewide, that are worried about, you know, what this design is, what its functionality is, and what it's going to look like. But, you know, just as a guy that has to look at the Eisenhower Bridge every day when I look into Wisconsin, you know, it's not plated with gold, so we're not going to get a gold-plated bridge here, so... We have to keep everything in perspective. Representative Morrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A number of us sitting at the table here had a chance to talk with state representatives from Massachusetts and some federal experts as well on lessons they learned from the Big Dig project. And even though that was a much larger project, their insights, they said, would apply to any project over $50 million. And one suggestion they had was to hire an independent consulting or engineering firm. And their description of that role was to be the taxpayer's watchdog, take an eye at all the change orders, to watch the overruns. And they had no skin in the game other than to watch the money being spent. Is that idea incorporated in this project? And if not, could this idea be incorporated?
Mr. Chair, no, that is not anticipated. If you look at the jobs that we have delivered through design build, our overruns are traditionally around 2%. We are very, very cautious with being overzealous with the taxpayers' dollars. I think that part of our responsibility is being on the front line, if you might say, in making those decisions. We are not interested in being another Big Dig, and I'm very confident that we're going to spend taxpayers' dollars wisely, but I guess you could have a consultant that might perform those oversight roles.
Mr. Chair, I think if we go and rebuild the Commons area, 3594 in downtown Minneapolis, I think we'll do that for sure.
Yeah. Well, thank you, gentlemen. I was wondering if the Lieutenant Governor couldn't join us for just a few questions. I know that there's at least three folks that have questions about the overall financing of not only this project. You guys are out of here.
Should the lower tier go?
You can stay if you want. Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. There's several questions about the overall financing, and we've been kind of trying to keep them away from some of the staff folks at this meeting because, they don't have those decisions. Those aren't their decisions. First, we'll start with Senator Saltzman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And also, Commissioner, I just want to tell you that I was so impressed with the work this last weekend by MnDOT on 94. I drove over it last night. Please thank everyone involved with that. It was incredible work under horrible circumstances. So I just want to commend the department on that. They did a great job. Mm-hmm. If I might add to that, Senator.
Yes. Lieutenant Governor, Commissioner of Transportation, Carol Molnow. You will notice that the striping on there is not as good as it could be. It's faded a bit, and I know we have to redo that. But we needed to get it done last weekend. The rain didn't help us, but it had to be done, and we may have to go back and retype. But you're right. We've gotten many, many comments on the efficiency of doing what we did in a time of emergency.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so Mr. Chair, and then I guess, Commissioner, one of the things that we asked and great responses from the staff. Thank you so much again for responding to the questions. But one of the things that came up is we have been talking today, about 35W bridge reconstruction. And the focus has been on one bridge and the bridge. But in terms of funding, we need to look at how this decision is going to impact funding for other projects. And on page 4 of the response,
to our two chairs on question number six. There, a question was asked about if there is a need to delay any other projects due to cash flow. And the response was that, you know, the staff are exploring other options, looking at bonding, transfer of other state funds, you know, also borrowing from other state funds, and this really isn't answering the question. There is a list also, I think it's number J, that talks about the Metro District projects needing to be put under contract, and this starts to look at some of the issues that we're concerned about is how this impacts other safety improvement projects. Now, if we looked at this picture 3 weeks ago, I keep looking at this picture, this would have looked like a picture from a movie set. But for those of us who have been there, it is real. It is the unthinkable. And I think so that if we look at all we're going to address is that we're going to rebuild this bridge, we are ignoring a huge wake-up call that we all received on August 1st, and that's that we have neglected our bridges. So I just need to know, and that's, I think, why we're asking a lot of questions about the financing and funding, is that if we have a cash flow problem, and not only these projects that are on the agenda are delayed, what about all the other issues that we now have greater concern about with our safety of our bridges? We have school buses that are going to be going over all of these bridges, you know, September 4th. We're concerned about that. So that's where I think we are asking questions. Where are we at in terms of financing? I don't think we have enough resources at this point in time to just do this bridge and ignore what else is now on the table.
Well, thank you, Senator and Mr. Chair. I'm going to try to answer what I think you're asking. When we do this bridge, this bridge alone will have federal financing. We've been approved for and actually put into an account for us $55 million that we can draw on through invoice right now. We can do that. The dollars for this bridge, because of when we get paid after money is appropriated into the fund by our national delegation, will make a difference. But when it comes into the fund, we can invoice and to the federal government, and we're hoping that turnaround is quick. If that's true, and knowing we have $50 million up front is very helpful to us. We don't see, the bridge itself will probably, for the most part, be paid for with those federal dollars. So we don't see a lot of issues with having to do other things. Now, I know Abby McKenzie and other people of our staff have told you how we can flex and how we can borrow some resources to repay using the collateral, the federal dollars to reimburse those accounts, because we know that will come forward. So if that's what you're asking, I think we have a pretty good plan to have the least amount of negative impact on the program we have in place.
Lieutenant Governor, I believe the question is, are there going to be other projects delayed because of this delay in payments from the federal government?
I'm hoping that there will not be. I don't believe so. I think we do have some resources that we can move to. If we have a project we're going to let, we could bond rather than pay out in full right now if we have to do that, and then reimburse the bonds using those federal dollars. So I think we can pretty much take care of what we need to take care of on this project, if that's what you're asking for, with hopefully not a lot of negative impact to other projects or delays.
The bonding authority that you're talking about, where is that from?
I'm assuming, now, I think we can bond for some of that. We do have some authority to do some additional bonding, so I think we can do that on some of it, knowing that it would be short-term, or we can do short-term borrowing from other accounts, and we can do that.
Funds, is that the...
We could use 14? Some of those, yes, but we also have opportunities, at least from what we've heard as we've talked to the Department of Finance, of being able to, and we've done this before, knowing there are dollars coming in behind us to do some short-term borrowing.
Mm-hmm. Representative Madure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner Molnow. I have a question here. When I look at this list that Senator Saltzman is speaking to, It lists $158 million worth of projects in 08 that are left, and if I add the $55 million that you tell me we have available right now cash on hand, that brings a total of $213,475,783. That shows then we're still $37 million short of available dollars that we need to spend to then invoice to the government, to get to the federal government, then to get back here to the state of Minnesota. So my real issue with that is that I understand we may be able to draw out some of those payments. There might be other things going on. But one of the highlights over the last few weeks are the newspaper stories going about the state and looking at bridges. And I'm noticing here on this project list that we do not have the Lafayette Bridge down. And I'm wondering where that falls in the project list. And are you looking at then postponing letting 2009 projects if we have any kind of delay in getting the federal reimbursement?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I can tell you that, can I guarantee there will be no delays because we're doing an emergency, we're in emergency status? No. But can I also tell you that I have talked to Rick Kafka, who is the Federal Highway Administrator. He was sitting in your audience the other evening when you had your last committee hearing, joint meeting, and he did tell me that the $250 million is not necessarily a cap. So that doesn't necessarily mean it's the only money for emergency money that would be available to Minnesota. That was what he told me, and I take him at his word. I also, I'm not sure if you're asking, will this bridge delay other projects into 2009? And we'll have a legislative session between then and now, and that time. We can get bonding authorities to move things forward. Other things can occur during that session. So I'm not going to say that we're going to hold off 2009 projects. When you folks actually have some responsibility and authority in the meantime.
I think I'm done, Senator. Thank you.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I remain gravely, gravely concerned about the safety of the people of Minnesota. And the bridge that fell down was not on our ratings, the worst bridge in the state. And so I do not hear the urgency with regard to the rest of the bridges in the state. And we have a list of the structurally deficient bridges before us, and I wonder how that divides up with functionally obsolete, which I don't see the separate category for functionally obsolete and don't quite get the distinction. But my question is, what is the plan to fix the bridges, not just the bridges, and by when? And what do you need from us to make sure we can respond with the kind of urgency that our citizens demand?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative.
Senator.
Senator, I'm sorry. You're small. I just thought maybe you went the other way. But I will tell you, Tim, we are very concerned. Our top priority when it comes to bridges and comes to safety is they are the top priority. We would shift money from other areas if we needed to do that. And so from what you're asking me right now, I'm telling you that if there's a need, we will do that. We have already, through the fact that Minnesota was one of the first dots to actually measure our performance out there, and we measured that, and the reason we do that is to find out where in our budget do we need to put more emphasis. One of the areas we know we need to put more emphasis is in preservation and maintenance. So a larger portion of our budget will be going to preservation and maintenance, and that's part of our budget proposal. So I can tell you that we would never, ever deal with or let a safety issue, particularly on a bridge or anywhere, not be the number one priority, and those would be addressed first, and they would take priority.
Lieutenant Governor, you say that you're going to do what's necessary to fix those bridges up. You know, in southeastern Minnesota, where a majority of these bridges are that we've been talking about that are structurally dysfunctional or structurally deficient,
Well, they need complete replacement now because they've been washed away. And if there's anybody in this room or outside of this room that don't think that we don't need a special session to deal with transportation issues, especially since what went on in my neck of the woods, they're sadly mistaken. Lieutenant Governor, this list of structurally deficient local bridges, only local bridges, is $790 million. And the local bridges, only local bridges, not state bridges, that have a functionally obsolete category is $210 million. Now, that's $1 billion worth of spending right here in these two sheets. Now, the budget for MnDOT at any given year is $3 billion, $2 billion. Okay, so we have half the state's budget's going to be tied up in fixing these two sets of just local bridges. Well, that's not your budget, so I guess it's not your issue, but, you know, if we don't have more money applied to the CASA formula, MASA formula, these bridges aren't going to get fixed. Unless Senator Langseth and Representative Hausman have an opportunity to bring in a bonding bill that looks like five Brinks trucks hooked together, we're not going to be able to address these bridges. Now, Lieutenant Governor, you're supposed to be the spokesman for transportation, safe transportation in our state. Go to the governor and tell him we need a special session with real money so that we can fix real problems. These are real problems. And the lieutenant governor was, or I mean the governor was down in my district just the other day looking around at real problems. And it's millions and millions of dollars just in my district. And it was just a small portion. Now, there's more areas in Winona County, Houston County, Fillmore County that probably have a larger dollar impact. But in one community that I represent, it was over $5 million of damage in infrastructure. A couple bridges washed out, railroad bridge, a couple roads. That's just in one small area. We need more money, and we need to have an honest discussion on how we're going to get real money on the table. Now, the Senate is going to be putting together a bill, or at least the guidelines of a bill, that I would hope that the House would like to join hands on. And we're going to ask for a large infusion of money up front so that we can start addressing some of these real problems. And we need to get this political thing about we don't need a special session, we need a special session, this is on the table, that's off the table. That's all a bunch of hogwash. If we don't need a special session now, we don't need a regular session next year, or the year after that, or the year after that. We can just take the keys, throw them out in the streets, leave the lights on, and pretend that everything's okay. Everything is not okay, Lieutenant Governor.
Senator Murphy, I'd sure love to comment on that.
All right.
You know, we do the funding. She's the Commissioner of Transportation. We do the funding. We all do the funding.
Senator, passed the bill and it got vetoed.
If you have a Senate and you have a House, so it got vetoed, then that means that at that time something should have been worked out. I wasn't in leadership at the time, but I will tell you what, something should have been worked out. You know, that's the way government works. There's a governor, and then there's a legislative body, and we present bills, and we do the funding. She doesn't, the lieutenant governor here, she doesn't do the funding. We're supposed to get the money for her.
Senator Day, you missed my point. My point is that we've got a House and a Senate that recognize a problem. We have an administration that says we don't have a problem. How do you rectify that, Senator? Senator Day, do we have a problem in transportation?
I've never heard the governor say we didn't have a problem in transportation.
Well, why can't we pass a bill?
No, I carried his $1.7 billion. I carried a bill for him. A couple of Democrats voted for it, and all the Republicans voted for it. He had a plan the last 3 years. The last 3 years.
Senator Davis.
It's the largest construction years we've ever had in the state of Minnesota, year after year after year.
And our grandkids get to pay for it.
I've said before, Chairman, it doesn't make any difference if your grandkids have to pay for a road or whether they have to pay for a new building.
or whether they got to pay for a bike path or a swimming pool. It doesn't make any difference about our grandchildren. If they can use the roads and bridges for 30 years, there's no reason we can't use bonding for it. And the people out here, they voted in MVET, $200-300 million. Why we don't want to leverage that and did that big package, I don't know. But everybody else had a 10% gas tax. And that's fine. Everybody can vote for 10% gas tax. I'm not. Gas is at $3.
That's only 2 cents, Senator Day.
What?
10%. 10 cents is how I get it someplace. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the concern we have is the sustainability of the borrowing. When capital investments write the bill, it's not set in statute, but we for a long time had a formula, the 3% figure, and we stay within that. None of us are asking how much can we borrow for roads. This is a new phenomenon. We used to pay as you go for roads. But this borrowing for roads is a new thing, and nobody's asking the question what's sustainable. But we did, at least in the House Committee this year, see, was it a 20-year chart to say what's the debt service, and is there that much money coming in? And there were a number of years when it was red. The numbers were red. And so I think the department's own numbers have shown us that this borrowing plan isn't really sustainable for the long term. I think what brought us together is we have to replace a bridge, and the administration said we want to build it in an expedited fashion. And so what we're trying to figure out is the financing in place to do that? When we hear language like flexing the dollars, borrowing, then paying with future dollars, that is what we've been doing for a number of years now. And a number of us have had concerns about it, even in good times, because what happened in that recent history is we always seem to be in crisis mode or emergency mode, shifting from priority to priority. I don't know if there are still county commissioners in the audience, but I know numbers of them have been told, your project was scheduled for 2014, now it's 2020. In the best of times, not responding to an emergency. So it is the sustainability of that borrowing that none of us have determined. We just started down that road and we assume it's unending. And these large numbers we're hearing today, when the plan is still bonding, without the question of long-term sustainability of that, that is what leaves a huge question mark in our mind. That's, I guess, comment and question
responses. I'm not sure I heard the question, Representative Hausman, but I think I do know what you're saying. I understand that borrowing has not been something we did in the past because the gas tax could sustain the need for transportation. That's not true any longer. It won't sustain it into the future. We know that. I think we heard Congressman Oberstar say that the federal account in 2009 will be short of money unless something happens. And he said under his watch he won't allow that to happen. So I'm not sure what his plan is to not have that happen. Right now it means that we're getting 85% of those dollars that were in safety lieu designated for Minnesota. And it doesn't matter whether it's part of the $500 million in earmarks, it's still 80 to 85% of those dollars available to us. So we have to match those as well. The cost, the inflationary cost of building roads has increased significantly for a lot of reasons. Some of them are great reasons. We do an environmental piece where we say we replace wetlands 2-to-1. And that's not a bad thing. The part of that I disagree with on that is that we take it out of the trunk highway fund. We have to build the infrastructure, whether it's for rail, whether it's for roads, whether it's dredging, but replacing it 2-to-1 and taking those dollars out of the highway fund, I think it's wrong. I think that's an environmental issue that we as a state have to prioritize and make that part of that side. And that would help us with some of the costs, but we do that over and over again. We have issues with aggregate in the Twin Cities. whether it's available or not and how long it will be available, because we're doing very little to preserve the access to that aggregate. So those things are all going to add cost to us. We mandate other things. We mandate some soft things. We mandate a lot of things that we do. 98 permits we do before we can dig some dirt on any construction project. I'm not saying that's bad, but I am saying that there's a lot of duplication, and all of those cost us dollars. So do our dollars go as far as they used to? No. It does cost us more. But we are actually, we do have some plans put together, and the governor did have a good plan. I know you don't like borrowing, and I hear people say our grandkids have to pay for it. I will tell you today, my grandkids, all five of them, use the roadways. Their moms or dads take them, and they use them, and they feel comfortable with that. In the same way that in the future, they'll be using those buildings of higher education, and they'll be using those just as they're using K-12 education today. And those are all bonded for the most part. So when you're talking about long-term infrastructure, I think it's appropriate. I do, to a certain point, to a certain point. And I think we're at less than, is it 12% of our package would have been bonding. And that's not an overabundance of doing that. The other side of it is the cost savings we have in inflationary savings when we're looking at 12 to 13% increases per year is significant. So that we do pay a rate of interest, but we also have some savings on the other end, to say nothing of the fact that we have the benefit of having that infrastructure today rather than waiting. So there are some benefits to doing exactly what we do for long-term projects. I'm not sure if I answered your question or not, but I
thought... Well, we've got a bunch of questions left here. We've got Senator Langseth, Bonoff, Representative Solberg, and then we've got Carlson, Junbauer, Earhart, and Dibble. Senator Langseth.
Well, Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I was chairman of this committee for 14 years. At that time, we did take cash for everything, and we kept up with everything. But it's been 19 years. 19 years. Now, the Senate has always been passing revenue increases, and we couldn't get it passed. This year, two-thirds or better of both houses passed a revenue increase, and we couldn't get it into law. There's some people in state government that are in denial. You're in denial if you say we don't have to get some more money into the system. We have to get more money into the system. We are at a point now we can't do the job needs to be done with cash. We have to complement that with bonding. I understand that, because we have gone for so long. But, you know, people expect to have to pay for the things that they get. And now, if this bridge wasn't a wake-up call, and you shut down a bridge across the Red River up going to Drayton, North Dakota, which I think you were probably right in doing, those farmers are going to have to go 25 miles with the full load and 25 miles back extra, 50 miles to deliver one load. Do you think a 5-cent gas tax makes much difference to those people? I think we are way overdue, and somehow democracy doesn't seem to be working anymore. When two-thirds or better of both houses pass a funding bill, it should be in law today. And we are going to have to do something, and this denial business is going to have to stop. We have got, you know, I paid 50 cents less for a gallon of gasoline yesterday than I did about 3-4 weeks ago. And I've seen it go up the other way. If we can't get a nickel or a dime, there's something wrong with our leadership. You know, I always used to say here, and it was considered conservative, that we should leave the wood pile higher than we found it. The wood pile is being depleted. It's being depleted. And I think we better get back on track. We need more money in the system. And you know, there was an editorial I read not too long ago said, Here's the solution. You do the legislature's revenue and the governor's bonding. Well, what was the bill?
The bill was $1.5 billion, I think it was, Bonnie, wasn't it?
Huh?
Okay, let's go to $1.7 billion. And then let's do the revenues to support that. But we're way overdue, and we had better get with it and do something. And we better do it quick.
If I might respond to that, I assume you want a response of some kind. Well, first of all, the bridge that was closed, partially closed yesterday in up in Kitchen County, had to do with a stringer that we found during an inspection that really could not be support the weight and needed to be repaired. The bridge was scheduled to be repaired next year, replaced actually. And so right now they're out there looking at what they need to do, and we'll start action on repairing that bridge. And the goal is to get it done before the sugar beet season, which is starting shortly, I assume.
It's tomorrow. Tomorrow.
Well, it may not be done by tomorrow, but I know they have limited traffic on the bridge. They have limited to one lane, and I don't know that trucks can go on the bridge at this time. But I know that they're out there doing exactly what they can do as quickly as they can. But I think what I've heard you say is we need more resources for transportation. And I have never rejected that. What I think we do also have to do is prioritize where we spend our dollars. When I was chair of the committee, and Bernie and I worked together very carefully on a lot of issues in a nonpartisan way, but one of the things we did is we did look at some general fund dollars, some one-time dollars, and that's actually the approach that Representative Obistar is talking about, Congressman Obistar. He's talking about looking over a three-year period of time, putting some additional resources in for bridges, and then going back to the way it was. And that's the same option you folks have. You can prioritize this and say, this should be a priority. This is where we ought to put some resources. There are other things that are nice to have, but let's put some resources there and make it a priority. And that's
well, Lieutenant Governor, you know, the thing is we are the transportation committee of the House and Senate. You're well aware of that. We've got nothing to do or very little on the control of where some of the other money gets spent. Now, if the governor wants to come forward with a plan to cut other services in health and human services or education or pollution control or DNR or whatever to divert that money to transportation, I'm willing to listen to those ideas. I think we've got Representative Solberg, I believe you're next.
Mr. Chair, just one observation, if I may, and I want to pick up a little bit on what Representative Hausman said, and that is that the cash flow for paying off the bonds is a little disturbing, and I've seen those charts put out by this administration on those, and they do go down into the red. And so we can't have that particular type of activity going on long-term sustainability. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's somewhat disturbing is that the last bonding bill that we authorized 4 years ago was paid for supposedly by efficiencies within the department. And I think we've been talking in the metro area of bridges now, but I drive 65 and they're finally going to put a little coat of tar on it. My wife drives it and she had her cruise control on. And it was so rough to knock the cruise control off. And I really caught that. I should have had her call you instead.
That's what comes to do that. I got 65 too as well.
That's all. But what I'm saying is that I think in our division or our district, we lost, I think, $2 to $3 million a year in maintenance budget to help pay for the bond. Mm-hmm. That's some of the efficiency. And that's the difficulty that we have. Mm-hmm. And it's okay to bond, but you have to have a way to pay for them. I had to borrow money to put a roof on my house, but I had to have a way to pay for it. It just didn't go away. The bill came due, and I had to have some cash flow long term to be able to pay for that. And I hope if we do a bonding program, we also address the way to pay for it, so we don't go into the red. That's an editorial comment and not a question.
Well, thank you, Representative Solberg. Senator Bonhoeffer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had a follow-on question to the question that I had asked you, because I didn't feel like I had gotten a complete answer, Commissioner. With regard to my concern about safety, and I do believe that you share that concern about safety, but with regard to the concern about safety and what I perceive as a lack of urgency, what I am looking for is a list. Instead of just receiving a list of the bridges, I'd like to see them rank ordered in terms of worst case to best and by when we're going to fix the problem, and then be able to evaluate if that satisfies the public and us on this committee who have responsibility for making sure the public is safe, that we think that that's addressing those safety concerns with the speed that we think is required. So I don't know if you have that ready at your disposal or if that's something you could prepare, but that is something that I need to see in order to feel like I'm doing my job as a legislator.
Well, Senator, I think we can probably get to a list of the ranking. We do have the ranking somewhere. But some of the definition, and if you ask the folks at the Federal Highway Administration right now, if they really believe they should have ever used the terminology deficient, they would say no. It doesn't necessarily mean unsafe. And when you talk about inefficient, structurally inefficient, or obsolete, one of the things that means is that the shoulders aren't wide or there are no shoulders on some of these, especially in rural areas, as the senators talked to us about. It doesn't necessarily mean, or that it's substandard to today's specs or requirements. It doesn't necessarily mean they're unsafe. What it does mean is that they don't meet today's standards in a lot of cases. So there are other bridges with other classifications. So if you want a complete list of where we're going to target the bridge work systematically, we can do that. On the rural or the local roads, the local bridges, typically those are paid for. A lot of that is paid for through the bonding that we started several years ago. Bernie and I remember we were there when we put bonding packages together for the local folks. And that actually replaced some of those substandard bridges with everything from culverts to big box culverts, because that was what you needed to do. And we've replaced thousands of those so far using that program. So a lot of those, and some of the bridges that actually were washed out, Senator Murphy, in the area of the flooding, that's really a devastation down there, I will tell you, had been replaced, but they could not withstand that kind of water rush as we could see north, put a lot of the area, the road surfaces or the shoulders. So I actually would have been there today if I wasn't here. But I will be going down tomorrow or the next day. But we do have to look at what's needed down there, and we will address those. The other part to that is, in those cases, there are some federal dollars that will be coming and made available for some of that fixing as it relates to sewer and water systems and that kind of thing. But if you're asking, can we get you a list of which bridges are next on our list to be replaced, the answer is probably yes.
Thank you.
All right, we've got Representative Carlson, and then Senator Carlson, and then Earhart, Jungbauer.
So apparently the Carlson delegation is up next. There used to be four of us at one time, so we're down. But at any rate, I did have a question or a comment, and Representative Fulber touched on it a bit. We're using maintenance dollars for the debt service on the bonds, or prioritizing, or however you phrase that, I think is questionable. But at any rate, where I was really headed is the terminology that you use, Commissioner, on the cash flow question. And I'd like to have some feedback from you on what you mean by the terms you use. Least amount of impact. That implies that there must be some impact, but we never really heard what it might be. You would use terms like pretty much, hopefully not a lot of negative impact.
Thank you.
That means that there's apparently going to be some impact, and you didn't really give us any kind of a benchmark as to what you mean by hopefully least amount and so on, other than I'm only walking away with the feeling that there's going to be some negative impact, and I don't know how much.
If I could answer that, Representative Carlson, when I use that terminology, what I really mean is there are, when we had our project list for last year, and the year before, when asphalt went up 64% in 18 months because it's petroleum-based, was there some negative impacts of the project? Yes. I have no idea, and I can't foresee some of those things happening, or the steel prices going up, or the concrete, or the price of diesel fuel. That's something that has gone much higher than our projections would have been, and they did have some negative impacts on other project areas. We had to delay for a short period of time because of that, or someone had to delay for a longer period of time. So there are other factors other than just what's there,
and
what this will have, the impact this will have on it.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may, I understand that. But the question was framed in terms of the cash flow relative to the cost of the bridge and the payments on the mm-hmm. cost of the bridge, and that's what you were responding to when you were using the terms that I was quickly jotting down as you were answering the questions, because it, in my mind, was saying that there's going to be a negative impact with the cash flow related to the bridge to some degree, and I have no idea to what degree you were referring to when you say least amount of impact, hopefully not a lot of a negative
okay, and
impact.
That really
you're implying
is
something there.
Representative, that really is relative to how quickly the dollars come to Minnesota from the federal VR dollar appropriation. A lot of it is reliant on that. When we can right now invoice and literally pay out of the $50 million for the debris removal and some of those things as we invoice, we go through that, it can be paid for because the dollars have been made available to us. Until the appropriation is made at the federal level, we're limited to what the Secretary Peters is willing to upfront for us. And typically that's not done for a lot of, that isn't done in a lot of cases. We're very fortunate to have that done in the sense that there is some money in the account that could be used for that purpose. My hope is that those dollars will be appropriated sometime in October, and they will be made available to us on a pretty regular and current basis. If there's a long delay for whatever reason, it doesn't get appropriated, whatever, that could negatively impact us. I don't have that measure. We don't have complete control of that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. Let's see. We've got Senator Carlson now.
Madam Chair and Mr. Chair and Madam Commissioner, I have two question areas. One of them, I guess, is firstly, I want to have my concerns settled and the concerns of the people who we serve. I have this list of 72 bridges. These are sorted by the condition by, it says, deficient and have sufficiency ratings less than or equal to 50. There are 72 bridges on this list. And unfortunately, that was number 72, the best one on the list. Now, this is something that everybody can download, and lots of people are looking at it. And we need to comfort them that we're going to be looking at this and taking care of it so that we don't have another tragedy.
Mm.
What can you say to me that's going to make me feel comfortable that I can say to the people who are looking at this?
Well, I don't know if I'll make you feel comfortable at all, but what I am going to tell you is what the NTSB and others have told me. And what they said is this bridge collapse is one of the most unique things that happens in the country. This does not happen very often, the way this occurred. This happens when something hits a bridge abutment. This happens during major flooding. This can happen during major weather catastrophes. But this does not happen very often. And I think you listed three where this has occurred. And I don't know, but I think they have a pretty good idea of what caused this bridge to collapse. The governor immediately asked, and we are performing those bridge inspections. Those do make a difference, and we're doing them along with some help. We've had to hire some private contractors to help us to do this in an expedited fashion. We do this on a regular basis. That's one of the reasons we found the damaged bridge that we just talked about towards, shared with North Dakota. So we do find them, we do react, and we do make repairs. You don't always hear about them, but they happen. I doubt that you probably would have heard about that North Dakota-Minnesota bridge had it not been for this bridge collapse. So what I can tell you is that this is a very unique, terrible thing that's happened, but it doesn't happen often. And I don't know why this happened, but we will find out.
Mm-hmm.
So to raise your comfort level, I guess, if that's what you're asking, is that we will continue to monitor and do what we need to do, and safety of a bridge or any roadway is always the first priority. So yes, if we have to hold up another project because of an emergency safety issue, we will do that. That's the priority.
I guess thank you, Lieutenant Governor.
The concern I have is we want to be sure that that it's not business as usual. The other question I wanted to touch on was, you mentioned before about moving some funds from different accounts to handle things that are shortfalls. Now, are all of these accounts funded by our fuel taxes and our cab fees? Because those, I believe, are constitutionally dedicated to only roads and bridges. Isn't that correct?
Roads and bridges and the highway patrol. Yes, pretty much.
And now, we don't take any of those funds out of there. Is that correct?
If you mean, I'm not sure, take them out?
Divert them to other uses.
No, they're used either by the state road system or the local road system.
Okay, and the reason I'm asking that is in the Wall Street Journal, there was an op-ed piece that said that our transportation dollars aren't scarce. Minnesota spends $1.6 billion a year on transportation, enough to build a new bridge over the Mississippi River every 4 months. But nearly $1 billion of that has been diverted from road and bridge repair to the state's light rail network. Has that happened?
If you're saying from a federal subsidy response?
From road and bridge repair to the state's light rail network.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know that I can say that's the dollar amount, but I know we do, when we build a roadway, especially in the metro area, we have done shoulder enhancements, we've done transit enhancements that are part of the road project. So if you're asking, could that have been done? Sure. Did we use right-of-way that was bought with trunk highway dollars for the Hiawatha line? Absolutely. Yes. Those were diverted, if you want to call that diversion.
$1 billion?
That did happen. Are there other examples of that? We do donate land and provide park and ride opportunities or access to, and if you think of that as a subsidy, that does happen. We probably use some road right-of-way for a lot of the stations where light rail is stopping. So if that's a diversion, that occurred as well. So I'm not sure if that's what you're asking for, but I do know that has happened. I will also tell you that we used to be even worse than we are today, if you think that's, if you're negative on that approach. We used to spend highway dollars for kiosks all over for all kinds of funding, and we worked very hard to clean that up several years ago so that we weren't going to the Mall of America and putting up kiosks paid for with trunk highway dollars, because we did do that.
Oh, Lieutenant Governor, when was that we did that?
Oh, that was probably back, when did we clean it up? In about
No. When did these expenditures happen?
Probably before that. at when the Mall of America was first put up.
Can you provide some written documentation
to
myself and cheerleaders?
But I know we put kiosks up in other areas for bike paths and markings, and we did do that. We have built bike paths as well with highway dollars. We do that. Actually, I can tell you that Congressman Obama...
Lieutenant Governor, I believe the question was, was there $1 billion of gas tax money spent on light rail in this state?
And I don't know the total, but I can't tell you the total amount. But if you're asking where do some of those accounts for light rail costs, I would say probably do.
And I guess, we have another article here, which is in the St. Paul Ledger. And Representative Phil Prinke is writing similar words, saying he's talking about your predecessor, and he said, couldn't it be the same Commissioner of Transportation who diverted millions of gas tax dollars from road and bridge funds to augment the construction of light rail? Now, I believe this was probably done when you were the chair of the of this committee. Did you authorize borrowing millions from gas tax to augment light rail?
If you're asking, did light rail pass? I did not borrow millions to augment light rail from gas tax.
Lieutenant Governor, we're getting way off the line here.
I thought so too, but keep that.
I know. Lieutenant Governor, I would ask that you provide written documentation with numbers on it that shows how much gas tax money was spent on the Hiawatha line. And
do you want to frame that in, are you including right-of-way, that sort of thing? Because
how much gas tax money, Lieutenant Governor, I'll make it very simple, how much gas tax money was spent on the Hiawatha line?
Okay. So we'll include anything, any cost, so right-of-way would be
you
included.
Put it down the way you want, and then we can pick through it and figure out if it was an appropriate loose use. Members, we're going to be done in 20 minutes. We've got Earhart, Jungbauer, Dahl, Holberg, and Olsen.
Representative Earhart says, Mr. Chairman, that the counties are doing projects that the state doesn't have the money for, and I think we're in hock to the counties around $100 million. You can comment on that if you like. And we're the state are at the public federal trust, trying to get money out of them all the time. Some people here in this state were Scandinavian, and they used to kind of pull themselves up by the bootstraps. We ought to be doing our bootstrap bit now to get the money into the transportation structure that we need, and that's just saying it in another way it's been said before, but we already have that liability to the counties, so...
Well, Representative Earhart brings in a good point. I mean, we already owe them over $100 million,
yes.
And now we're going to borrow the CASA and MASA formula funds, that's gas tax money, to help leverage the money for the North Star line. Now, there's a lot of people in this room that think that that's a very inappropriate use. One of them happens to be the chair right here. But we need that North Star line, Lieutenant Governor, to get finished ahead of schedule to help alleviate some of the mess that we're in because of this. So I'm not going to raise a big stink about it, but we better get a funding package in a hurry. Otherwise, the counties and cities are going to just go absolutely, they're going to go bonkers.
If I might, can I talk to the $100 million that counties and local units of government have lent MnDOT, so to speak? Most of those dollars are moving projects forward that were going to be moved forward, for instance, a year or two ahead. That's what happened on 169 in Belle Plaine. The local units of government advanced those dollars. We had it in our program, in our SIP, to be done few years later. What happens is we paid the cities back when the project was scheduled to be done. So yes, we have done some of that, and they are paid back when they are scheduled to be built in the SIP. So that does happen.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Jung Bauer, he left. Senator Dahl. We have Dahl, Holberg, Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've kind of asked this question a few times with the different people who've had it testifying, and Lieutenant Governor, I wanted to ask you, Mayor Eierbach had talked about the congestion issue on the north side of the bridge, and that we're looking at the big picture. It seems that we keep going back into a pattern of wanting to get this bridge done as efficiently and quickly as possible, and I think everyone wants to get it done as quickly as they can. However, if we've got a unique opportunity right now. Unfortunately, it's due to a disaster, but we do have a unique opportunity to address the larger picture, and we know that this bridge and this thoroughfare is of regional importance, and the economic costs that are going with rerouting traffic right now, I think it's been estimated at $400,000 a day. We're going to be rerouting our lives as well for the next 12 to 18 months with this. Wouldn't it be prudent to look at, again, that bigger picture of the congestion issue on at least the north side of the bridge? When I've talked to the other testifiers here from MnDOT and from Chair Bell, from they talked about it being a priority, that if we just make this a priority, those that have to do the expedite the permits and the reviews can do so. And if we don't make that choice now, that by building this bridge, trying to make changes halfway through this, we're only going to cost more money. And that if we try to address these issues even 5 or 10 years from now, we still have to go through the same issue of rerouting traffic or bring it down to a single lane, which has a huge economic impact as well. There's only one person really that can make that choice now in the process that we're making, or that we're going forward here. And you have that his ear. Can you talk to the governor about making that more of a priority at this time?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl, I think what I heard you ask, two questions, sort of. The opportunity to do the north end of the bridge and possibly the south and both ends, and get those done at the same time we do the bridge itself. Okay.
As possible, yes.
Yes. The bridge itself, because we were able to use expedited environmental review and all of that and get our permits quicker than normal, not less scrutiny, but quicker, that piece, the bridge itself, will be able to be built much quicker. The abutments, however, because they don't meet the ER emergency standards, would have to go through the normal process. And that probably would not be a process that was speeded up for, or set up, I should say, for environmental reasoning. And so it would take much longer for that. But the other part to that is we have nothing in design for the other end. And the connects to, doing the end, but they might connect to something else. We actually don't just do the project, we do the system. So we have to make sure that whole system could flow. So it's a longer term plan than just a year in the process. But it's not, I do not believe, and we can have Frank come up and talk to us, and I've talked to the Federal Highway Administrator and our local representative here, Tom Sorrell, and asked them about the possibility of them happening at the same time. They're on two different planes because of environmental and design scrutiny and the cost it would take to move them up in plans. There are no plans right now to do these.
Right.
So that would have to be adjusted. There may be right of way that needs to be purchased. It's a much longer process than what the bridge itself takes, and the reason for that is the bridge itself is following the same footprint. Even though it has more lanes, the ends do not provide for more traffic flow. Therefore, the air quality issue is not an issue for the bridge, but it would be adding lanes to the ends, because that would be able to increase the capacity on the bridge.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up, I guess I was under the impression that if, and I understand like right of ways and things like that would have to be looked at and could lengthen the process, but that
some of the permits and the like that were going on were not necessarily due to the emergency provisions, but more that people were being cooperative, that they were finding ways to dig in and get things done a little bit quicker than they normally would because of the focus that we have on the bridge. And that if we made it a priority, that we could move through some of those channels a lot more quickly than we normally do. And my concern is, I guess, that we're going to have a bridge now that it'll be a modern bridge with a 5-lane capacity and capacity for light rail or bus rapid transit, and it really won't lead us to anywhere because it'll just lead to a bottleneck at the front and back end of the bridge. And it concerns me that we have an opportunity now that we could address, even if we can't get it done at the same time as the bridge, that we're working on it concurrently and we're putting that into our plans so that within another year or two we can have that bridge or that those approaches fixed as well.
I understand what you're saying, and I think in the onset what you said is closing the road to do that at one time while the bridge is being built made sense,
mm-hmm.
and it does if you could do that. The other process would take longer.
Thank you.
Thank you. We've got Representative Holberg and then Senator Olfien, and then we're out of here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to make the point, and I'm sorry that Representative Carlson wasn't able to stay, but I think that, you know, we have to recognize that we don't have control when the feds let loose past the $50 million, and that makes it a little hard on this whole cash flow issue, and so I think that supports some of the unknowns that the county governor was talking about. And I guess it's also confirmed by the situation with North Star, in that, yeah, you're going to get the federal money, but might not get it as you need it. Again, that's a federal disbursement issue, and they don't have a lot of options in how to deal with it. And then to Representative Solberg's point regarding the borrowing, I think the point has to be made is that over the life of the governor's bonding plan, there was well in excess of $100 million beyond what the debt service called for within that program. And certainly there were, I believe, 3 years in which the cash flow was a little bit in the red. But I just want to make sure that people are aware that the governor's bonding plan did cash flow over the life of the program.
Well, that's still debatable, Representative Holberg, and we'll continue to debate that. But
and in the interest of time, we can take this one outside later.
Yeah, yeah, we'll go play tennis outside on that one. So I believe we had Senator Olfien.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Lieutenant Governor, just a comment. The bridge that was inspected in North Dakota, the inspection was warranted, according to Senator Scoy, because a truck hit it. So it wasn't a random inspection. Their truck had hit it, so then they felt they were obligated to inspect it. So then the damage was found at that time. That's what Senator Scoy said today. But my concern is that...
Actually, could I counter that? We do have our bridge person here, Dan Dorgan, and that is not what happened. That's absolutely not what happened. Dan, could you come up and just explain so they do have the facts? Because I think that is important that you do hear what really did happen.
Good afternoon. I'm Dan Dorgan, the State Bridge Engineer for Minnesota DOT. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, sorry, I just stepped into the room, but if we're talking about the bridge at Drayton on Trunk Highway 11, that was inspected as one of the accelerated inspections that we mentioned a couple weeks ago that the governor requested the DOT perform. That bridge had been inspected in May, a routine inspection, but we went out there again this week and did what we call a fracture critical inspection of it, so a very in-depth inspection. So the issue was not a truck hit. It was actually found in the approach spans to the bridge. So it wasn't the area that is fracture critical, but it was in the approach spans. So you know, there could have also been a truck hit maybe somewhere else that I'm not aware of, but the reason for inspecting it was part of these accelerated inspections that we were doing.
So, unfortunately, from a tragedy, we are starting to find that there are other bridge issues. But, and I guess that kind of leads into my main question or comment is that I see it meant out a culture of, and I believe this is from the top, that you know, we're not addressing issues. I mean, every day you go into your office, The granite facade there is at risk of falling off, and there's scaffolding to protect citizens as they enter the building. Yet with the veto of the transportation bill, the money to fix that wasn't there, and I didn't see anybody coming up saying, you know what, this is an emergency. If the facade starts falling off this building, we're in big trouble. Another point I guess I would like to make towards that is, Congressman Oberstar, I was kind of taking quick notes, so I don't know if my percentages are correct, but it sounded like on the revision money, 41% of the money sent back to the feds was for bridge projects. So if that's true, I mean, we're not establishing that bridges are a priority, and that was going on for a number of years. I guess I would... and then last week I had asked a question about the engineers, and I appreciate the answer, but I don't like the answer because going from 516 engineers or professional folks like that, well, maybe I should use the number. From 2002, it was 825, and now overall engineering net, whatever that is down to 699. At a time when we're hearing about, you know, all these additional dollars going into transportation, all the projects being done in the state, yet the in-house number of MnDOT staff engineers has dropped quite dramatically. So I guess those are three points that lead me to my conclusions, whether they're right or wrong, that there's a climate at MnDOT from the top that kind of establishes what happens down below, that, you know, we're not going to operate this system the best way we can, because I don't see it operating the best way it can. I've got bridges in my area that have been delayed and overlays that have been delayed for years and projects just, you know, pushed off. And I don't, one last thing, in state government budget, the auditor came to us and said, we're losing people because of Sarbanes-Oxley. We've got people going to private, they work for the state, they learn how to do accounting, and private sector sucks them up. I'm seeing this probably with these engineers. I bet a lot of these folks are going to private engineering firms making a heck of a lot more money than they are at the state, but nobody came to our transportation committee and said, hey, you know what? We have a problem retaining engineers. And to me, there is a problem retaining engineers, and if it's salary, I think it would have been appropriate to come and say that, you know, we can't keep engineers because the private sector, you know, we hire them as a consultant after they leave us, but we can't retain them because of our salary schedules. Well, if we would have known that at the legislature, I think we might have worked on that. So those are things that, for me, are compiling evidence that we have problems with Minnesota Department of Transportation the way it's operated.
If I might respond to a couple of those, and I'd like Dan then to be able to respond to a couple that were inferred in the Senator's statement. First, when you talked about the facade of our building, we did have that put in the, and I'm sorry that Senator Langstaff is not here, because the request was put in for the general bonding bill. The Senate chose to put it in the transportation bill. No other building really is in the transportation bill but for that building. We don't own that building, by the way. We lease it, and yet it was put in the transportation bill. I think that was put in there. I'm not sure why it was put in there. I think maybe you might want to think about why you would not make sure a building that had some concern for 5 years, not just the time you've been here, but 5 years, was not being taken care of. So that's an issue if you might want to talk to folks and find out why it was chosen to be moved over to another area when it should have probably been done out of the general...
Well, Lieutenant Governor, that's here or there because the governor vetoed both of those bills, so it wouldn't have made any difference. So you're splitting here. Mr. Dorgan, in 2005, you came in front of our committee and you said, I just visited a bridge that fell down, and I believe you said South Dakota, or was it North Dakota, one of the two. And you said you feared that that could happen here. What have we done between 2005 and 2007? What have we done?
Senator Murphy, members of the committee, I think what you're referencing was a discussion of allowing higher truck weights without changing the truck configuration. That was the context that we were talking about at that time. And you're correct in your recollection, it was a South Dakota bridge that had been collapsed due to an overload agricultural load at the time. You know, our concern would have been at the time to allow heavier trucks without changing state laws as far as how many axles and what kind of length they would have had. So that discussion was in that context, Senator. But back, I think, to the more general question and, you know, the comment of a pattern of neglect or a culture of neglect. I can tell you on the bridge side of the business, and I will only speak for the bridge side, that is certainly not the case within MnDOT. In fact, if you go and look at the actual numbers of what we have been spending for bridge contracts since 2002, we're averaging somewhere around $120 million. In some years, we hit $174 million in bridge construction. Some of that's new construction, some of it's replacement improvement. I'll get back to that in a moment. But just as a comparison, if we look at the years 97 through 2001, we were spending about $45 million a year in contract work in those years. So there has been a very large increase in our construction programs since 2002.
Is it enough?
Is it enough? Well, it was enough in those years. In those years, we were spending about $70 to $80 million in bridge replacement and bridge improvement, and that was on target for what we projected we needed to spend.
Is it enough today?
Going to the future, good, excellent question. Going to the future, no. At that level, we'll need to increase funding. And I think, as Lieutenant Governor mentioned earlier, there's unanimous agreement that additional funding is needed. The method of funding, of course, is one of the issues of dispute. But going to the future, more funds will be needed, and particularly as our interstate system and in the large investment we made in the 1950s and 60s comes of age, and that's occurring, those demands will continue to accelerate over the years. So going forward, additional funds are needed. I think that's a consensus in the room for everyone. But, you know, the neglect, I'd really like to, I don't think that's fair to our folks that are out there doing the maintenance, to those that are involved in this business. And our actual maintenance expenditures, if we look from 2004 to 2007, we've actually doubled the amount we spent on maintenance, on bridge maintenance.
And that is because it was in dire need?
No, that was because of a readjustment of priorities within the department a couple of years ago. What we developed was called the Highway System Operations Plan, where more money and funds were going towards preservation and preventive maintenance.
Mm-hmm.
And that was part of the preventive maintenance side for bridges. So there was an increase of funding devoted towards that. You know, given the fact, you know, with the photo behind you and the awful tragedy, I can certainly understand the questions on this issue. But I think we need to let the NTSB, National the Safety Board, do its investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Because as was mentioned earlier, you know, there's a set of unique circumstances that combine to cause this issue, which is fairly typical for these types of collapses. It's not indicative of our statewide system. Our bridges, not only the trunk highway, but the county, are some of the best condition in the country. In fact, if you look at a ranking, every year Better Roads goes through this. We're about number 6 in the country in condition. Now, that isn't to say more needs to be done, because the counties face the same thing that we do. They did a lot of construction in the 50s, 60s. Those are coming of age. Those needs are escalating, and even greater efforts than what we've done in the past are needed in the future. So the need is there. I mean, I don't take that away, but what I do dispute is that there was neglect on those involved in these efforts in the past. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I don't mean to intend that it's MnDOT employees. The point I'd like to make is that it's coming from the top, because I don't see the effort to say, you know what, that facade falling off that building, we got to do something right now to get it fixed. You said 5 years. Well, where the heck's the effort been for 5 years? You know, that's what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. If I might respond,
Lieutenant Governor, I think we're going to get out of here.
Okay.
Mr. Dorgan, I would just, and Lieutenant Governor, I held up two lists. One was for $790 million, and the other one was $210. We need more money, and we need it badly. This committee is going to adjourn, but not disperse. Thank you.